The Capital Investment Committee will come to order. This is the last chance of getting bills that have been introduced on the spreadsheet. Each person that's presenting should, don't worry so much about the presentation. Worry about that you're getting through to us the amount of money that you are requesting, what the local match is, what the need or want is, whether it's shovel ready for 2019 or we'll go through the MMB process for 2020. Other funds that you've received for this project or other funds that this project could leverage in addition to the state amount that you're asking for. Thank you. The first person on the agenda is Representative Garofalo with House File 22322. Representative Garofalo, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know, do you have a quorum so someone can move my bill or not?
Oh, we're not, we don't move bills. We just have the hearing and then they're put on to the spreadsheet.
They don't lay them over for possible inclusion or anything?
No.
Shows you how often I come to the Capital Investment Committee, Madam Chair, right?
This is your first time, I believe.
No, I think I had a bill in like 2005.
Yes, yeah. But I wasn't there then.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity for a hearing on this. House File 322 is a problem that you're seeing, I think, in many other communities, and that is that you have small communities that were designed with septic systems that have grown over time. They've reached a critical mass now where they really do need to convert to a wastewater infrastructure system. And given the higher requirements for pollution mitigation at both the federal and state level, they simply just don't have the tax base or the tax capacity to be able to afford that. So what this bill does is it asks for $4.9 million in bond proceeds. It requires non-state match of $2.4 million, of which $500,000 is from Dakota County. Again, I respect the fact that this is something that you're seeing. It's very common across our state where people need to upgrade their facilities. They need to. They simply don't have the tax capacity to do that. I will tell you, if you're ever looking for a place to have a short weekend getaway, Lake Bilsby is right down by this area. It's in the metro area, technically, but it's in rural Dakota County. It's just, you'd swear you're, just get all the benefits of northern Minnesota without having to make the long drive. And it's a great community school, five-star reading, five-star math school. And it's just a small town, and they can't have septic systems anymore. They got just too many failing, and they just don't have the money to pay for upgrading it. So hopefully you can consider this as part of your process and making sure that other small cities are able to do this as well. And Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Garofalo, I looked on the PFA list, and I did not find Randolph. Should I have looked for Lake Pilsby?
No.
They haven't applied to?
They applied for the grant, but I just don't think they've gone through the grant-making process yet. So.
Okay. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, how big is Randolph?
Madam Chair, there's Randolph and there's Randolph Township, and they go through annexation. So I lose track. You know, people who live in a township are moved into the city as land acquires. I think it's safe to say, you know, less than 1,000.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to Google that and look it up just to make sure I didn't totally screw that up.
Okay, it wouldn't be the first time. Sorry.
Yes. So. It'd be the first time. 452 is exactly what I thought it was.
452 divided by 4,000,009.
And so, and Madam Chair and Representative, that's, you know, this is the problem we have with small communities is that you can't really leave them on septic systems, right? On the flip side, you can't just let these existing septic systems continue to fail. But it costs a lot of money for communities that, you know, this is a community that's not going to be get absorbed by the suburbs for, you know, not in my lifetime. So it's a tough problem. I respect that.
How big is Lake Pilsby?
What's that?
How big is the Lake Pilsby?
I do not know, Madam Chair.
Do a lot of people have houses around that lake?
Yep, there's houses around that lake, and then it's there's a Dakota County Park that's on the northeast shore there. There's actually a hydroelectric dam as well in the southeast portion, which the state and Dakota County help funds, because if that dam would have failed, Cannon Falls would be swimming with Aquaman.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Juergens.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. Did you say that this would include Lake Bilsby?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Juergens, Lake Bilsby is part of Randolph Township, so it might be in the same service territory, but
not for your project.
That's my understanding, though.
Okay, that's what I thought. My in-laws live on Lake Bilsby, Madam Chair. That's why I wanted that clarification. The other side of the lake is actually Cannon Falls. So,
thank you for that clarification. Second item, House File 2576, Representative Olson. And then following Representative Olson is Representative Daniels with three. So be ready. Get down there fast.
Go.
Oh. And you have the two Olsons are here tonight. Welcome, Commissioner. Welcome, Representative. Please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Earlier this session, this committee received a presentation by DHS regarding the status of the 2018 bonding bill's mental health crisis center funding. And as you may remember, this provision included $28 million in statewide funding for building mental health crisis centers. The maximum award was $5 million. Individual counties or groups of counties were encouraged to apply, and DHS administered the awarding of the grants formally announced this February. For the most part, recipients were pleased and ready to move forward with their grant agreements, even if below what they'd requested. One county, however, St. Louis County, cannot move forward with their 28% reduction in full funding. Senator David Senjum has been a strong supporter of the Duluth Project and is the chief author for this crisis center funding last session, actually modeled his landmark legislation after the St. Louis County's proposed Clarity Project. This is a great project that has many stakeholders at the table and is ready to move forward once the funding is secured. And that's why House File 2576 is before the committee today. Here to talk more on this project is on the county's Clarity Project. Its groundbreaking approach towards mental health crisis treatment is St. Louis County Commissioner Beth Olson.
Welcome, Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Chair Representative Murphy and representatives. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. 3 years ago, with our jail overflowing and our emergency rooms clogged with people in mental health and chemical health crisis, our community came together to look for solutions. We started with analyzing the top 25 users of our jails, ERs, and detox, and this is what we learned. These same 25 people cycle through these extremely expensive facilities to the tune of $2.6 million a year. $2.6 million a year were being spent, and the people needing help weren't even getting the help that they needed. They needed help with their medication, access to treatment and other services, housing, advocacy, crisis intervention, and the list went on and on. What they got instead was a fractured, fragmented, and difficult to access behavioral health system. They were in the wrong place, but there was nowhere else for them to go. And with that, our Clarity Project was born. We immediately gathered all the players, everyone from both hospitals in our area to mental health providers to judges, public defenders, and more people got involved. After thousands of hours of work, including hundreds of people, we saw potential for a solution when Senator Senjum and his committee visited St. Louis County to learn about what we had been planning. After hearing our presentation, Senator Senjum put much of our model into the 2018 bonding bill for mental health crisis facilities. Our proposed Clarity Project became part of the basis for the bill and was used often as an example. The proposed Clarity Center will be a one-stop shop for anyone in crisis and needing urgent behavioral health care. Located in Duluth, close to the hospitals, the Clarity Center will serve the northeast region of the state, including Carleton, Cook, Itasca, Couchiching, Lake, and St. Louis counties, and the Lake Superior Chippewa bands of Boys Fort, Fond du Lac, and Grand Portage. People can get help by coming directly to the center, or with a call, our staff will go to them. We will start by providing triage and assessment of the current crisis. If they need to go to the ER because of a physical medical emergency or to detox because they are too intoxicated to receive care, staff will ensure transportation, a warm handoff to that facility, and follow-up care in the future. Regardless of how they access the center or their needs, people of all ages, including children, will have access to mental health and chemical health providers, medical professionals, including psychiatry, case managers, advocates, and peer supports all in one building. We will conduct substance abuse and mental health diagnostic assessments, which are the first steps to getting into treatment programs. This will shorten the time to get needed treatment, reducing the potential for crisis and demand on our emergency systems. We will utilize telemedicine to reach those further away from Duluth. For example, if someone has a panic attack in Grand Marais, they will not have to drive or go by ambulance to the Duluth hospitals to access help. They will be able to connect to the Clarity Center remotely and receive immediate crisis intervention and follow-up assistance. We will utilize the short-term crisis beds at our Birchtree Center, where people need more time to stabilize and be ready to go back into the community. We feel confident in the future success of our model because it will provide a common entry point, improving access to care, making sure that people don't fall through the cracks, provide each person with the unique services and help they need, improving that person's stability and reducing crisis, provide a response that includes the whole family and other key social supports, and lastly, it will save a lot of money because we are taking people out of high-cost, inadequate services and maximizing the community supports that are already available. We're doing our part locally. The county is putting in $1.3 million into infrastructure in addition to our bonding request. Our two local hospitals will provide staffing for the Clarity Center. Our local mental health providers and advocates are providing staff and have agreed to co-locate their services into this one-stop shop. The future of the Clarity Center hinges on the money we receive in state funding. We need the entire $5 million requested, or we will not be able to follow through on our plans. We ask you to restore the 28% that we lost through the DHS process. And thank you very much again for letting me come and talk with you today.
Commissioner, will you repeat the counties that are involved?
It's Cook, Lake, Itasca, Coochaching, St. Louis, Carlton.
Okay, thank you. And the three tracks, sorry.
Our Boys Fort, Grand Portage, and Fond du Lac.
Thank you. And the amount of money is this 1.365.
Yes.
And then that will make you whole, and that will make you allow you to open your center.
Yes.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Representing Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Does this serve both adults and adolescents, or primarily adults?
It will serve all ages, from young children to adolescents, adults.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Daniels. You have three bills for the academies, State Academy for the Deaf, the State Academy for the Blind, and the asset preservation for both.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I moved as fast as I could, Mary. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're flexible.
Yes.
Not very flexible. Go on.
We have, yeah, three different bills presenting tonight, all in for the Deaf and Blind Academies. The first and probably most important one is the security corridor. That'll link three different buildings together and provide much more security. Right now, there's really not a main door that you come in at the academies, and it's really not easy to have it secured. That's probably the most important in the list. And then we have asset preservation for both the blind and the deaf academies. Also, we have dorm renovations on the Kramer, Brandine, and the Road dormitories on the Minnesota Academy for the Blind. Pretty standard stuff, just like heating, cooling systems, just updating those. They've got a wing on the building there that One room would be at 50 degrees, and the room next to it would be about 80 degrees. So they just can't control the temperatures. Just needs to be redone. But I am not going to speak any longer. I have my superintendent from Faribault here with me tonight, and he is going to present all the details on the three different bonding proposals.
Your bill was heard in Education Committee, was it not?
That is correct, ma'am.
We are expecting a priority list from them, and so he doesn't have to deal with all of it.
Okay. We'll do the short version.
The very short version. Welcome, Superintendent Wilding.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to explain a little bit about our projects. And I'll try to keep it short. I know other people are waiting. The most important one is that Representative Daniels mentioned is the connection between the three buildings. I want to remind you that we have very young kids on our campus. We have kids as young as 18 months old in our school. We start classes all the way from 18 months all the way to age 21. So we have a variety of needs, and we'd like to make sure that our buildings are designed to protect our kids, and if a stranger comes in, that we would have a screening system where we can monitor who comes into our buildings. Right now, we're not able to do that. It's very important that we are able to do that. We're also wanting to add a better communication system that's more visually accessible for our deaf staff and students, and so they don't have to rely on hearing staff. So we need to set up a visual communication system. That's our first priority. Also, we want to have different funding mechanisms, or we don't have the funding mechanisms that public schools do. They can levy money. They have long-term management money. We can't use those funds because we're a state agency, so we depend entirely on your support for any projects that we have on our campuses. The second project is at our blind school. The dormitory was built in the early 80s before the Americans with Disabilities Act, before that was passed, so it's not really fully accessible. We have more and more blind students who also have physical challenges, who need special accommodations like lifts, wheelchairs, different access to the kitchen, the bathrooms, and their bedrooms. So we really need to upgrade to current accessibility standards to design our buildings to be safe and accessible. We also have parents who send their kids from far away to our schools, and we want to make sure that this is a place where they can access their living environment comfortably as they would other kids the same age. Also, we're a very old school. We were founded in the early 1860s, so our buildings are very old. We have some buildings that really need improvements to make sure, that they're safe, accessible, and comfortable for our students. So the asset preservation money will go toward different projects in the different buildings to make sure that we can keep up with current standards and codes related to accessibility and safety. So there are a variety of projects around both of our campuses. So those are the three projects that we're proposing. Thank you.
And for a total of $13.2 million, right?
That is correct.
Questions? Representative Daniels.
Yes, Mary Hart would like to speak too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Hartnett with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans, and our board supports this bill. There are only two center-based programs left in the state that provide education for kids who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. One is Metro Deaf School, a charter school in the metro area, and the only other program left is the School for the Deaf. It plays an important role for kids who aren't mainstreamed, and it used to be that the metro schools had options within Minneapolis and St. Paul, but those are no longer there. So it plays an even more vital role, and we're here to fully support their request.
Thank you, Ms. Hartnett. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
House File 2410, Representative Haley.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing us a few short minutes to present House File 2410, which is money for infrastructure renovation and stormwater mitigation for the Cannon Valley Trail. I will turn the testimony time over to Commissioner Brad Anderson.
Commissioner Anderson, welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Murphy and staff, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you tonight about the Cannon Valley Trail. For a little background, the Cannon Valley Trail was started 33 years ago by a group of citizens, and it is run by a joint powers board between the county, Goodyear County, the city of Red Wing, and the city of Cannon Falls. Each of those entities contribute not only financially to the operation of the trail, but also in kind and work along that trail with city staff and county staff. The trail is a connection between two state trails. It's run as an independent trail that is run as a fee-for-use trail. I think there's only a couple trails in the state that are run that way. This trail is a connection between the Milltown Trail, which travels out to Lake Bilsby and will eventually continue on to Northfield and Faribault. On the other end, it connects the Goodyear Pioneer State Trail, which goes out to Hay Creek and will eventually connect to Zumbrota, Goodyear, and on down to Pine Island. So it is a very integral part of that trail state trail system, even though it's not a state trail. It is a local trail run by local organizations. The ask today is for some funding for a couple of issues that are extremely hard for us to deal with. And just to back up a little bit, in 2015 we undertook a master planning process to go back and look at our trail after 33 years. What are the infrastructure needs going forward for the next 30 years? And we've identified a process where we're replacing bridges and we're replacing different pieces of that, and one of the toughest ones to deal with is the stormwater management. We have constant problems with the trail getting washed out from storms, which through our master plan, it's identified that there's 70% more severe rain events currently than there was 10 years ago, and each of those impacts the trail, and we end up with a lot of repair and that and things along that trail. So that piece of it is extremely challenging for us to fund and find funding for. Even though the local entities in this process are going through the master plan have all stepped up and are contributing more dollars towards infrastructure improvements and match money for grants, this piece is really hard to find grants and funding for, and quite frankly, Representative Haley has challenged us many times before we ever got to this point to find different ways to fund it. And we've talked to Soil and Water and MnDOT trail money, all kinds of different avenues, and we just haven't found it. So that's a very important piece. The other piece about getting modern restrooms on this facility or on this trail after 33 years is one other piece of that for the funding. I also have with me the Cannon Valley Trail current manager and the past manager who was there initially when this trail was started, who also is the person who did our master plan. So it's Scott Repke and Bruce Blair are also here. So are there any questions?
Have you received state money for this before?
Not through bonding. We've done grants, many grants, and through DNR or through Bowser or through Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails. So we have, but not really through bonding at all. This piece is just, especially the stormwater piece, is extremely hard to find funding to match with what we're already contributing.
And are you starting from scratch with the stormwater repairs? Are you,
when you say
working with an engineer?
Yeah, we will when we get to that point. Yes, and we've had engineers look at this as far as the process and the cost of doing it. I think it's like 20 some different sites along the trail that the stormwater mitigation is what we're dealing with. It also travels through the Cannon River bottoms, which is some lowland, and it's, you know, subject to some slight flooding, but that's not as bad as when we get the rain events that wash off the bluffs around Red Wing.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, I've ridden this trail. It's real nice. I parked in, I think, Welsh and went to Cannon and then back, and then went the other way to Red Wing and back, and it's a really nice trail, and you've got a good effort going there.
It's been a really good joint effort between, you know, collaborative effort between those three local units to manage and do this trail. And the trail is actually owned by Goodyear County. The fiscal management part is handled by Red Wing, and then the employee management part is handled by Cannon Falls. So it's really just been a fantastic venture in doing that. And with a fee for use trail, and there's not very many, and you can ride state trails free, using fees to generate enough dollars to do the operations isn't even feasible because people will just go where it's free. So it's been a challenge that way, too.
Have all three cities contributed financially?
They contribute on an ongoing basis every year towards the operation. And then when we finish the master plan, all three entities up their ante, and basically they're looking to do about 20% of the match money on projects along the trail.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about those fees. How much does a trail wheel pass cost? And if state money is used on this trail, can you continue to charge those fees?
Mr. Anderson.
I'm not aware of.
Did you ask what the current price?
Excuse me, will you please identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Scott Repke, the current trail manager of the Cannon Valley Trail.
Okay.
Did you ask about the fees?
Yes.
What they are? It's $25 per season and $5 per day.
And
in addition to the $25?
$25 for the full season of bike riding, inline skating, or you purchase a day pass for $5, and that gives you the day for $5.
Representative Lilly, is that what you did?
Madam Chair, yes, I paid the daily fee, and they're very serious. I got stopped by a guy in a truck, and I had to dig it out of my pannier. So I got to be honest, I wasn't exactly thrilled about that part. But I was going to be nice and not mention it.
A guy in a truck on a trail.
Madam Chair, he was quite serious about it. I felt sorry for the couple from Iowa because they had to dig theirs out of the pannier too. It's not in the honor system. You have to show it.
Kind of scary, though.
Apparently, we were the three of us. The three of us were not very trustworthy.
Apparently not. I can't understand that. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe we should hire that guy to work on a light rail system.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee members.
Actually, I have had to show my pass.
Representative Torkelson.
Oh, I'm up.
2504.
Why didn't you have tickets?
Madam Chair.
Oh, you have a friend with you.
I do, Madam Chair. I'm very happy to have someone who knows the ins and outs of this bill much better than I do, House File 2504, and former representative, current county commissioner, Michael Beard, is here to testify to the bill.
Commissioner Beard, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be back. And for the record, I'm Mike Beard. I'm not appearing as the Scott County Commissioner this evening. I'm appearing as the Government Affairs Rep for the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority, which is a collection of five counties, a joint powers agreement, consisting of Carver, Sibley, Renville, Redwood, and Lac qui Parle counties. And I'll give you a brief history about how that came to be and why we're in front of you for an additional round of bond funding this evening, if I may.
You may.
Okay. The Minnesota Valley Rail Authority, Madam Chair, is requesting $15 million this bonding cycle for the next phase of reconstruction of the Minnesota Prairie Line, as it's come to know. This segment will be rehabbed from Gibbon to about Franklin, Minnesota, about 12 miles of new rail on top of ties and ballasts that have already been in place and taken care of by the Rail Authority and by our operating company, the Minnesota Prairie Line Railroad. By way of introduction for the newer members on the committee, this segment of freight hauling railroad dates from the 1880s. Originally, it was built by the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad Company. Back then, they had visions of grandeur reaching the Pacific Ocean, and this was their attempt to get to the Pacific. They made it as far as a cattle crossing in the Missouri River when they ran out of money, and everybody else beat them to the Pacific anyhow. Over the years, it served basically as a Prairie Granger Railroad, an agricultural railroad. It was trimmed back through various abandonments through the 1960s to as far as Madison, Minnesota, which is a town in west central Minnesota. It was purchased by the Chicago Northwestern that year, eventually abandoned in 1984. Madam Chair, in another life, I did have the privilege of actually working on this piece of railroad when I worked for the Chicago Northwestern. Good people, terrible company treatment by the Chicago Northwestern. And so the several counties that I just mentioned formed a joint rail authority to buy this line when it was abandoned by the Chicago Northwestern. They recognized the experience that other small towns in Minnesota had in the late 70s and early 80s when they lost their rail service. The economic hit that their local economies took was really a sad thing to see. They said, it's not going to happen to us. So they formed the Rail Authority and purchased the line in the year 2000. That in 2002, because it was in such derelict shape between the shippers, the counties, the state of Minnesota, and the federal government, about $7 million was done in an emergency investment to kind of lift the thing out of the mud and make service possible. And because of the size and scope of the project, we're not doing all 94 miles at once. We're doing it in pieces. This is probably the bonding request that you get every year that's a little out of the ordinary, and that it's not done. We're doing it in sections, starting from Norwood and working west. We've now rehabilitated completely with new rail more than 40 miles of track, replacing all the old rail. Some of it is as old as 1912 we're taking out of the ground. The stuff we 7 miles we did last summer with your bonding grant to us in 2016, that rail, some of it was between 1929 and 1952. So that rail is out, the new stuff is in, and we've already had a new customer come online, a potash unit train facility being built in Fairfax. We've done over 150 road crossing rehabilitations to date, and just in the last 7 years or 5 years since I've been working with these folks, over 25 bridges and culverts have either been rehabilitated or replaced. So that's the request for $15 million this year, Madam Chair. You asked a couple other questions. Could this leverage other money? Yes. The last round, the $4 million that we got 4 years, 2 years ago, we actually used that as part of our Tiger Grant application process. We were not successful in that, so we went ahead and put that into new rail and did 7 miles of track. If you award us money again, we will use that, first of all, towards federal funds. The program that's replaced Tiger will be the first place we'll look, and we'll use this for a local match share if we would be successful in that. If not, we're buying new rail and laying another 12 miles of track, Madam Chair. I should point out that some of you saw it on the bus tour 3 years ago. I'm sorry you missed the train trip 2 years ago, but we do intend, the Rail Authority does intend to have another train, an inspection train kind of a program. We want to be sure your committee gets a ticket this year, Madam Chair, so you come and see it.
Hmm. Okay, questions? What's the total amount of money that you've received from the state?
Since 2002, from all sources, it's about $29 million, and it's rehabbed almost 40 miles of track. Well, 40 miles of track with new rail, plus the other 54 with new ties and ballast.
And how much more?
It would take about another 60 or 70 if we were to do it all in, right now to finish with new rail all the way to Hanley Falls. So I imagine we'll be back.
And so how much more business does 12 miles generate?
This next 12 miles will put the unit train facility, the potash facility in Fairfax, into play, and the Franklin Morton is the next place we're aiming for. They can start loading unit trains as soon as we can get up the hill with 286,000-pound cars. That will take more than 3 minutes to explain to you why it works that way, but it is very important that we upgrade the rail, so as soon as we do, there'll be unit trains coming out of there, I would say probably at least once a month. The biggest impact is to the farmers that subscribe to those elevators, because it means 8 to 10 cents extra per bushel stays in the local economy. Not just the employment at the mill and the trucks not on the road. It actually means real money stays on the farm, and that's the big deal.
Could you explain or could you send us information
Yes.
on the economic benefit of this investment?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Madam Chair. I do. I have the University of Minnesota Extension Department did a report for us in 2016. And the for the Tiger Grant application, we actually had to do a standardized deal. We used McKenzie and Company. That cost us $45,000 to standardize to what the federal government is looking for a level presentation on the cost-benefit analysis. I will make that available to your committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome back to the committee. And my question is for either you or Representative Torkelson. Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned about relieving the sort of truck traffic off the roads. Has anyone looked at really what that can be quantified at? And at the same time, when I think of that, if we don't have trucks on the road, then they're not paying gas taxes. So it impacts, you know. So I'm trying to understand this puzzle and how this sort of relates to that puzzle. If you could just explain that would be great.
Certainly. To be clear, trucks will always be required in this process of farm to market, because we have to get from the field to an elevator. So either we get to an elevator on our own line, which is just a couple miles away, or we haul it all the way to the Port of Savage or the river in Minneapolis, which is a much, much harder on the roads. And I hear contentions, and I don't want to sound anti-truck because I'm not, that the damage the trucks do when they're loaded, particularly when the roads are soft in the spring, doesn't come close to what the taxes don't come close to that. But it's part of what we do, because trucks are part of the engine of the economy, so we kind of work with that. To have them take short trips to the elevator is much more beneficial to the, especially the east-west road system that comes to the cities or comes to the Port of Savage, which is in the district I represent. We would much rather have unit trains coming down the railroad on that right-of-way than we would trucks on Highway 13 or Highway 19 or coming through Chaska.
Madam Chair, I would just really be curious if someone actually did a cost-benefit analysis, because if, you know, funding $15 million is saving us a few million dollars on road repairs, it sounds like it could be a good investment.
Yep, especially over time, Madam Chair. And I don't know, I can't put my finger on a report, Representative Dean, that quantifies that precisely, but let's check. I'm sure somebody somewhere would be happy to take that on. I'm thinking of CTS at the university. They're always looking for something to do.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Representative Pinto, House File 1446.
No. Would you like me to go ahead, or should I wait for him?
Do you mind?
No, I'm okay. You're okay.
All right. You heard my questions at the beginning?
Yes.
All right.
Okay, Chair Murphy and committee members, my name is Mary DeLate, and I am the manager of the Great River Passage Initiative at the City of St. Paul. I am here today because we are requesting $3 million to begin the process of building the River Learning Center and National Park Service headquarters along the Mississippi River in St. Paul. So this River Learning Center National Park Service headquarters is actually the gateway to the Mississippi River. It's a one-of-a-kind national feature along the full 2,300 miles of the Mississippi, and we would provide four-season programming that would teach people how to be stewards of the river and introduce them to the culture, history, ecology, and recreation of the river. The River Learning Center is proposed as a forward-thinking, mixed-use, shared space, it's a forward-thinking, mixed-use where we are sharing space and activity with the National Park Service. Our goal is to transform a strategic site along the river to a center of activity with river-oriented experiences. It's a wonderful opportunity for not only economic development, but river stewardship, as well as improving the health of the river and the health of the larger community. The site, which is the Crosby Farm Park Regional Park, is an important convergence along the Mississippi River. It's where the Minnesota and the Mississippi actually converge at what is called the Bedote, so it's a significant Dakota site. It's got very sensitive ecology in that area, as well as tremendous recreation and transportation connectivity. Not only is this an important site along the river in St. Paul, which is a river, the river capital, but also, of course, with Minnesota being the headwaters state along the 2,300 miles of what we're now calling the Fourth Coast. To date, we have spent about $100,000 on two critical studies. The first is a technical study to understand if, in fact, we can actually build along the river at this location. Because, as you know, the river is very dynamic, as we know what's going on right now. The second study is a feasibility study to understand what is this partnership between the city and the National Park Service. What are the revenue-generating opportunities, and what is the organizational structure? We have a number of partners. We have the National Park Service, of course. We have Mississippi Park Connection, which is basically their private fundraising organization, Wilderness Inquiry, Friends of the Mississippi River, Cap Region Watershed District, and also Congresswoman McCollum is a champion of this project. This is actually a priority of hers. Right now, the organizational structure is the city would build and own the project, and the National Park Service would be a tenant. The National Park Service at its current location pays somewhere in the vicinity of $300,000 to $350,000 in rent. That type of 20-year lease for this project would take care of maintenance and operations on an annual basis. We are moving forward with our local, state, and federal partners in lockstep across all the jurisdictions. I have to say, we are also including the General Service Administration in this process because, of course, they're the ones that manage partnerships and leases for the National Park Service. The last thing I want to say in terms of partnership is we have just had newly created the Great River Passage Conservancy. The Conservancy is the private fundraising arm for the capital projects along the Mississippi and St. Paul, and most specifically the River Learning Center and National Park Service headquarters. The five founding members for this conservancy include leadership from the St. Paul, Minnesota Foundation, leadership from Prairie Island, leadership from Mille Lacs, Xcel Energy, and Flint Hills. So they are a working board who are rolling up their arms in preparation for fundraising for this project.
So this project, total cost of this project is $3 million?
No, the $3 million will be used for design, permitting, partnerships agreements, and potentially site preparation in this dynamic location.
And who pays for the building then?
Well, that will be a joint fundraising effort. The capital costs will be a combination of looking at local, state, and federal dollars, as well as private dollars raised through the Conservancy.
Whose idea was this, the state's or
this idea was originally
it was originally
put forth in the Great River Passage Master Plan, which was adopted by St. Paul in 2013. Since then is when we joined in partnership with the National Park Service because, of course, they've been looking for a headquarters along the river as part of MNRA, for quite a long time, and this was a wonderful opportunity to create a joint headquarters where we are sharing spaces as well as sharing activities.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Light.
Thank you very much.
Good job.
Thanks.
Representative Lee, House File 2132.
Hey, just in time.
Oh.
Best presentation of the bill all night.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present House File 2132. This bill is asking for an appropriation of $3 million from the bond proceeds fund to design and construct the 26th Avenue North overlook, and I would like to turn it over to my testifier, Adam Arvidson, with the Park Board.
Mr. Arvidson.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, representatives. The project before you today is the 26th Avenue Overlook in North Minneapolis on the Mississippi River. It's a $3 million request that is matched by $1.3 million in philanthropic donations, most of which is already secured. The key local need for this project is that the neighborhoods in North Minneapolis have been historically disconnected from the Mississippi River by industry that was located up and down the river. This particular location at 26th Avenue would become really the only access point between neighborhoods in North Minneapolis and the state and nationally significant Mississippi River throughout the heart of North Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis, one of the Park and Recreation Board's great partners in all of this, has already built an off-street bikeway all the way across the north side, which connects to Worth Parkway on the western city limits. And this would become the eastern terminus at the river of that parkway. The best part of the project, though, my favorite thing, is that this particular location on the river is only a quarter mile north of the northern end of the existing Grand Rounds. So by creating this overlook point and then connecting that quarter mile, you get about a 40-mile loop within the city of Minneapolis that has never before been available to North Minneapolis and downtown residents. That Grand Rounds also connects way beyond the city of Minneapolis through other trails operated by Three Rivers and the state. In fact, you can get all the way out as far as Hutchinson from the Mississippi River if we make this connection. That connectivity is a critical piece of the need. It essentially allows an underserved community, historically underserved community, to get to the state and regionally significant resource that is the Mississippi River. This project is shovel ready. Through philanthropic dollars already in hand, we've been able to begin design work. The land is public right-of-way, and so therefore is under public control, and construction could begin later this year. And again, when we talk about leveraging of other funds, I just want to note the city of Minneapolis has already put significant resources into the cross-city bikeway. We have raised, with our partner, the Minneapolis Parks Foundation, the philanthropic dollars necessary to complete the project. The Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board historically has and continues to invest significant money into the Grand Rounds system, of which this would become a link. And with that, I would be happy to stand for questions.
Representative Lee, anything else to add? I don't see questions.
That's all, Madam Chair.
You must have answered them all individually.
Thank you. That's Mr. Arvidson from the Park Board.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Salk, House File 450.
Ms. Chair, and we are here to present a couple of projects that are going to exist in the portfolio for Rochester City, particularly addressing issues of my exercise plan, which I'm averse to exercise, but this is bike trails that I can get on, and the lake that's being proposed is one of my favorite rides, so I want to tell you that it's particularly important to my personal health. Our Mayor, Kim Norton.
Mayor Norton, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and we really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about House File 450, We are requesting $2.75 million in bonding for the Cascade Lake Regional Park. As you consider the opportunity to partner with the City of Rochester on this project, I'd offer the following comments for the committee's consideration. First, Rochester has a culture of care and compassion and hosts over 3 million visitors per year, primarily linked to the Mayo Clinic visit. This investment will not only give our city residents an outstanding park experience, but it also creates a positive experience for the time people have before and after they receive medical care. The types of investments being proposed at Cascade Lake Regional Park provide the right blend of active and contemplative recreation that our community, our visitors, and their families need. Secondly, in addition to the $2 million match, which you asked about, we have also changed this gravel pit into a park over the last 25 years, and some of that included land acquisition, and that's cost upwards of $10 million to date. This recent $2 million that we acquired for the park improvements, making us shovel ready, which I think you asked about, has sparked a new enthusiasm to have this project advance. Third, even with limited development to date, we are already seeing annual visitor use in excess of 100,000 people per year, with great anticipation for the time this project is completed. Finally, property adjacent to Cascade Lake is projected to be the end point of a transit village or transit hub that is being developed to facilitate enhanced transit services in Rochester. In addition to creating enhanced transit service, this transit village will feature mixed income housing with a particular emphasis on affordable housing, which is needed in our community and all across the state. Key features of the project include an amphitheater, a park pavilion with restrooms, a drop-off area with ADA accessibility, and enhanced play features, which are also for adaptive recreation. As a community, we have a strong track record of thoughtful collaboration with the state, and this project has the potential to add significant value to local, regional, state, national, and even international visitors that it will serve. On behalf of the city and the citizens of Rochester, I want to thank you for your time and your consideration of this important park.
Thank you very much. Representative Salk, anything else?
I don't believe so.
This is it. Questions? No. Thank you very much. House File 384. Representative Salk.
384 is on the other end of the city from on my bike trip. So I live in the far northeast corner of the city, and I can get on the bikes just outside my door, get on the bike trails, and go across one stoplight to get it all the way down to the southeast corner where this trail will get put in. So it really is the final kind of southern connection of our complete city bike system.
Hmm. So do you ride twice as far then? Will you ride twice as far every day?
Generally, once we get out of here, I'm out every morning and I go for somewhere between an hour and a two-hour ride. As fast as I can go.
And if we do 450 and 384, then you'll go for 4 hours?
Probably. I will. If that's a stipulated element, I will do that.
Ms. Deason, will you please put that down in the notes for language changes? Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Salk. Perhaps you could work something out with Representative Davids, where you would go maybe to Preston and ride on his trail with him, too.
I picked on him earlier in taxes, and I think I need to let him rest.
Oh, all right.
Yes. Rest is good. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question might be related to the other. I'm assuming there's some type of local match that's associated with it. And I don't know if I was just somewhere else, but if you could speak to that, that would be great.
Sure. On the
Norton.
On the last bill that we're talking about, not this one. Because I
can address. Well, both actually.
Okay. Yes, there's a match to both. The last one we asked for $2.75 million. We have a $2 million match, and we've invested $10 million to date of a variety of funds. And this, the last one is for the regional lake and the park associated with it. This next one is actually a trail, and we do have a match on that as well.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
50%.
Thank you very much.
Is that enough? You don't want to hear any more about it?
No.
Heck. Easiest committee I've ever been in. Thank you.
House file 2568, Representative Lilly.
Too bad he's the person presenting.
Thank you, Mayor. Her mayor. Wow. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was sick of the mayor there. So nice to see her. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this is a request of for a trail project, geo bonds for $1.1 million on a local highway system in the East Metro. It consists of three cities. North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale are right there. And there's also two counties, Ramsey and Washington. So it's a bit of a mess to get it all organized. And it's close to Highway 36 and 694, so it's kind of tucked all in there. So there's definitely, I'm having passed out as some plans that were done years ago of a trail. And then one of the maps kind of shows, like, so that's of the plans of the trail. And it's right around the lake, which would, you know, connect to other systems. And then has a picture of the lake kind of that it would go around, and then it ties into the White Bear system. You might recognize this gentleman. We had him here the other night with the White Bear folks, and it very connects very much with theirs. Also in the crowd is I don't know where he went. He's gone. The head of the Bicycle Alliance. Maybe he's here for your bill, but he's part of their group. Yeah. And very much cares about the whole connectivity of all this. But I, Madam Chair, if you will, I'd just like to
Mr. Brooks,
please. Thank you.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Brooks, and I am the co-chair, if you remember yesterday, of the Lake Lynx Association. It's a White Bear Lake area nonprofit. We organized in 2017 to influence the implementation of safer conditions for people walking or bicycling throughout the area. This is a color map of the overall network plan of the black and white image that Representative Lilly had shown to you. His project is down in the lower corner. You can see that it connects to the Gateway State Trail. What does not show there is its importance to Century College, which is probably the largest community college in the state. It has probably 33,000 cars a day going past it and no facilities whatsoever. Yesterday, I presented to the committee about our multi-year effort to produce a safe 10-mile route around White Bear Lake. I mentioned that the Around the Lake Trail was part of a 2001 regional vision for non-motorized safety and mobility. The Lake Lynx Trail Network Master Plan, which Representative Lilly's plan or project is a part of. This Washington and Ramsey County approved plan identifies 8 trail corridors that, when completed, would dovetail into a strong regional network, creating broad access to and between local, regional, and state trail assets. House File 2568 is concerned with one of these corridors. It's the Silver Lake-Maplewood corridor, and the trail would parallel Minnesota Highway 120. Let me describe to you a bit about this road and why this trail is needed. This segment of Highway 120, Century Avenue, is roughly 3,700 feet in length. It is signed for 40 miles per hour on its northern end. As Representative Lilly indicated, it has Highway 694, which sees 80,000 cars a day. On its southern border is Highway 36, which sees close to 39,000 vehicles per day. And on this segment of Highway 120, which is essentially a two-lane road with an occasional turn lane, it sees an average of 12,000 motorized vehicles per day, according to MnDOT. Over the course of the road, there is an ever-changing percentage of pavement that morphs from a varying width shoulder into a dedicated turn lane, which then disappears into a minimal shoulder of a foot or so, offers zero separation for anyone walking or biking from traffic. For the few hundred feet where there is a curb, people have worn a narrow path above it, and when the curb disappears, so does the path. The final 500 feet at either end of Highway 120 is consumed edge to edge by traffic lanes and turn lanes, and when you get down by 36 before you can cross the highway to get to the Gateway State Trail, there is a sidewalk with a light pole and an anchor in the middle of it, kind of preventing you from using it. So really, when you look at this road, there is literally no consistently safe place to be in the corridor unless you are inside of a car. Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. Any questions at this time?
Thank you, Madam
Apparently
Chair.
Apparently not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Juergens. No, not that. Thank We're you, good. Madam Chair. Representative Lilly, is this the road that goes right past the Lilly Estate? Is this a trail that would benefit you in some way?
Representative Lilly.
I believe that there it would help my part of my family, yes. But
you, though?
Pardon me?
No, in all seriousness, we were actually...
No, it...
Does this go near...
Well, it's one of the... Madam Chair and Representative Juergens, it is close to where I live, and, I mean, you can't get closer. but it's one of those awkward situations. It's very dangerous. I don't know who can carry it if I can't. I thought about giving it to Representative Fisher, but...
I remember when we were there, the traffic there, and that's why I was joking, but I was in all seriousness too wondering if that was the same road we were talking about.
Mr. Brooks, how many of those Century School people ride their bikes to school?
That's a good question. I can't give you a specific number. I can say from meeting with the president of the college that because of the absence of connections, the Vento Trail further to the west, this connection, how to get to the college on a bicycle safely, has diminished the number of people who do ride. The trail I mentioned yesterday would certainly bring people up from White Bear Lake and points further west. With the completion of the Vento Trail, you would have traffic coming up from St. Paul and those communities, even over from Minneapolis. It's not a network until it's all connected. And so this is just one of the links that would aid in getting students to the college. But right now, once you cross the highway, I mean, we're stopping this project today that we're talking about at Highway 694. Once you get across 120 to where the college is, there literally is no place to ride anyway. So this is part of the reason why you don't see the bike racks filled at Century College.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And your request is for $1.1 million?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Crenshaw, House File 2025.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You may begin.
And I do have an amendment.
It's well, tell us about it. We don't move. We're not moving the bills. We're
Understood.
Not moving the amendments. We're just knowing about them.
Yep. So all the amendment does, and it's for clarification, is the project that you have in front of you is a bonding request for a military museum and the Minnesota Fishing Museum and Hall of Fame. And so this is just to make sure we got that in there because we didn't. That was inadvertently left out.
And so the connection has been made and the agreement has been made, and you're going forth with that idea?
I have both members here.
Let's hear it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I go any further, I do want to thank your community administrator who caught us in the basement of the Capitol and was very kind and talked to both of my. So thank you for that. That was very nice. Madam Chair and members, I have with me a bonding project for the Military Museum at Camp Ripley. I have with me on my right Randall Dietrich, who's the current director of the Minnesota Military Museum, and on my left I have with me retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert DeRozier, who's the executive director for the Minnesota Fishing Museum. I won't spend a lot of your time. I wanted to make sure you had questions, and behind me I have Commissioner Larry Herkey from Veterans Affairs and in support, as well as Don Kerr from Military Affairs. So this project in Camp Ripley, we have the Military Museum, which, by the way, Madam Chair, you helped us with 6 years ago when you were State Gov Chair, as we were archiving and moving materials up to the north. And now we need to take this a step further. The FAA has asked for safety reasons that we move this out of the encampment. It's right on the flight path, as well as it limits the amount of visitors that can come in and use the Military Museum. And there's a number of other reasons that bringing this out to 371 would give us more visibility. At the same time, we have another state asset that many people do not know about, and we're expanding that, which is the Fishing Museum, the only one of its kind in Minnesota, and we believe only one of three in the nation. A couple more, but a great combining of efforts for these two. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Randall Dietrich to go ahead and give his testimony.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Dietrich.
Randall Dietrich, Executive Director for the Minnesota Military Museum. Our 40-year-old museum currently is packed with 50,000 artifacts, and the most eye-catching of those might be the dozens of outdoor displays, including tanks, aircraft, vehicles, and artillery pieces. Our campus on post stretches over 6 acres and is housed not in one building but in 12 small ones. We are open year-round, convene public programs statewide. We love to host school groups coming through the museum, and we make available 15,000 history books via our lending library. But over time, a number of factors have contributed to the need for one new museum building to better accommodate what is now stored in a dozen aging structures. The building that houses the majority of our displayed artifacts is nearly 90 years old, was not originally designed as a museum space, or for that matter, to even have running water, and is failing. Two, there is not sufficient space to adequately host larger groups in the museum, or for that matter, our ever-growing collections, which includes those of General John Vesey, Minnesota's most decorated veteran. And three, this space was built before the active airfield directly across the road from what is now the museum, which includes low-flying C-130s. And the FAA has since ruled that there must be a plan to move the museum, and no new construction is permitted on this site. The Minnesota Military Museum envisions a new building just across the gate near the State Cemetery and Mississippi River as the best option to continue our work and bolster our attendance and increase exposure to our state's military heritage through a collaboration with others, including the Fishing Museum. Together, our two museums have been collecting and creating distinctly Minnesota stories for a combined 70 years. Together, we recognize that while we commemorate the past, our work is all about the future. This new space will enable us to inform, engage, and even entertain Minnesota families like never before, including hosting veteran reunions in this sizable space, which is 75,000 square feet at just over $300 per square feet, and will serve as a community, regional, and state resource. In closing, I'd like to call your attention to the letter of support authored by Veteran Affairs Commissioner Larry Herkey, as it outlines the safety, location, size, conservation, and programming justifications for this bonding bill. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Dietrich, when the FAA issued their find someplace else to go, did they offer any money to go with it?
No, ma'am.
Is there a possibility that they will?
I don't foresee that.
Well,
I don't foresee that they'll be making monies available. Our hope down the road at some point that this will be a federally supported installation, museum space, once it's built.
Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Dietrich. I'd just like to say that I have visited your museum several times and find that there are a lot of impressive displays in there, but you are certainly correct that you are cramped. Mm-hmm. And a larger space would be beneficial to you and to the people of Minnesota. So hopefully at some point in the future we can address that.
Thank you.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could, I'd like to let retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert DeRozier just give a quick on why pairing up with the Fishing Museum makes a ton of sense.
My name is Robert DeRozier. I am the president of the Minnesota Fishing Museum and Hall of Fame. About 30 years ago, a gentleman from Sartell, Minnesota, decided that based on all the heritage and cultural aspects and economic impact that fishing has on the state of Minnesota, that we, the state of fishing, deserve a fishing museum. He traveled the state looking for a prime location and got a welcome from Little Falls that caused him to locate his museum at that location. We believe that this collaboration will provide a central location for two museums that are currently about 6 miles apart, providing many opportunities for visitors, school children, civic groups come to our area to see museums. Locating them both together we see as quite an advantage. Lastly, we have some programming overlap that we might be able to work on. For example, if you were to watch any TV show or a sportsman TV show on Saturday mornings or Sunday mornings, you see many of the fishing shows have a lot of veteran guests on their shows, the veterans themselves and their families. With our Hall of Fame assets that we have, Gary Roach, Mr. Walleye, Ron Shara, people like that are already supporting the veteran activities. We think that this would be a good advantage to having the two museums located together. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And where are you located right now, Mr. DeRozier?
We're located in downtown Little Falls in a small structure with leaky roofs, antiquated floor space, and we likewise have a significant shortage of space. The citizens of Minnesota have donated enough artifacts that we are locating many of our artifacts in the back of semi-trailers and off-site storage facilities.
Rev. Sankrusha, you indicated that you were interested in having a site where more drive-bys would stop in kind of thing. Is there a location in mind?
Yes, Madam Chair. We are pursuing I forget how many acres, but right outside Camp Ripley on 371, just south of the State Veterans Museum or State Veterans Cemetery. So it's a prime location for people going up to the north, whether they're stopping in, and it's an amazing amount of people that stop in right now for Camp Ripley for either the cemetery, active duty, or just for memories, and also for fishing going up and down the 371 corridor. So we believe this would be an excellent spot to actually bring some of that traffic in, let them stop, go through the military museum, maybe stop and pay respects to somebody at the cemetery. And one of the things that is very common is people that have military experience and memories probably were fishing as well, or they have a relative that was fishing. So all these tied together, and we are working on a couple of things, which is securing local dollars to help out, as well as a connection with the DNR, because we believe this would be an excellent space for getting advocacy out for fishing. If you just saw recently, there was a big call to action. Dennis Anderson had written in the Star Tribune about the lack of advocacy for young anglers. We're trying to bring all this together. What other good benefits would you like us to do? Because I'll offer those, Madam Chair.
I'll let you know. Any other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not so sure if Director Dietrich or Representative Crenshaw answered. I look at this dollar amount. It's $26,883,000. So where are we in the project that we can get that precise with what the need is? I mean, has there been some preliminary design done, some preliminary pricing? Do you have some agreements relative to acquiring land and those other types of things? Just sort of, you know, I mean, if this was $28 million, then I wouldn't be asking this question, but you put down $26,883,000, so I'm curious where you're at.
Sure. Madam Chair, is Representative Dean asking us to go to $28 million? Because we can.
No, he's not. He just wants precise.
So, and I can answer a little bit. As we started this and started putting the square footage together, if you're familiar with the military and camper, I mean, they're very good at this, putting together the cost for those. And that's the original plans for this are on that footprint. So that's how this has come together. And I believe Larry was, and if you'd like, Commissioner Herkey can speak to that because he was very instrumental in putting that together. So if you'd like, I can call him up and he can give you a more precise answer.
He seemed to be nodding, and he would like to come and say how he got that number.
We're still within
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, this is Commissioner Larry Herkey, Commissioner of the Veterans Affairs. I was, in a previous life, I was the construction and facilities management officer, worked at Camp Ripley, and was responsible for all the buildings. So that's probably the reason for the precise number. Okay. Specifically to your question, what we took is three projects that have been done recently in the Camp Ripley area, on or near Camp Ripley, and used that information along with knowledge that I have of construction and working with the construction and facilities management office at Camp Ripley. So that's why the number is so specific.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there a deal, a good deal, coming from where you think it's going to be located?
Madam Chair, I was just up there. I checked the sight lines. They're excellent from 371. So I think what you're hearing from the other testifiers here is true. We're just by being exposed and being seen and getting out and outside of the gate, I think there's going to be significantly more people coming to this. I think the combination of the Fishing Museum with the Military Museum will also be a draw. And the benefit to us is we can use a lot of the common areas for both museums and work together. So I think that's also a benefit to all of us. We don't have to pay for it twice. The same bathrooms they're using, the same bathrooms we're using, same with some of the program spaces throughout the building.
Is there any chance that the land might be donated?
Madam Chair, that's probably not true, but we can focus maybe our funding as it relates to the fundraising that we're doing locally on that particular effort.
Oh, there is fundraising doing.
We are planning to do fundraising as part of this project, Madam Chair.
And asking people to participate and join in. And
Madam Chair, that's
very costly, and maybe we could get the $26 million down to $26 million.
I'm sure we're going to work on that very hard. That's the
25 million.
I can't make any. I think our goal is $1 million is what we're looking for, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is House File 2129 and House File 829, and I'm hoping that they will be. One or the other would be a vehicle bill. And Ms. Anderson, would you come down and explain what the Rural Finance Authority funding is to us very quickly? No, Ms. Valvo, Representative Anderson.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. This bill is for funding for the RFA Rural Finance Authority, and that was established back in 1986 as the state's effort to help finance some of the ag operations. And with the tightening economy in ag, this is critical today as we go on. There is money left in the account, but the Assistant Commissioner will explain to you the need for additional funding in the RFA account, Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Bobble. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Yes, for the record, my name is Andrea Vavala. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. First, I just want to thank Representative Anderson and Representative Murphy for your support. This program, as Representative Anderson said, the Rural Finance Authority partners with local lenders to provide affordable credit to farmers. As you probably saw recently, the farm economy fell 8% last year. And is at the worst it's been since the early 1980s, so before this program was even began. We've seen usage grow quite significantly over the last few years due to the fall of the economy, and so we have a little bit of money left over for from last year, but we anticipate to go through that money by the end of the year, probably more around October or November. So this is desperately needed for a number of our programs that we participate in, particularly for beginning farmers, ag improvement, and restructuring loans. So we would appreciate your support, and we appreciate you taking time to listen to us ask for this money.
Okay. And you're asking for how much, Representative Anderson?
My request is for $35 million, Madam Chair.
And House File 2129 has 40 in it, so they're pretty close.
I like yours, too.
So do I.
Any questions? Thank you very much. House File 2529, Ms. Dahlman from MnDOT, would you please come and talk about Safe Routes to School Grant Program?
We got two of them?
Good evening, Chair and Representatives. My name is Amber Gelman. I'm with MnDOT's Office of Transit and Active Transportation, and I'm going to talk to you tonight about House File 2529.
Could you speak about this a little louder?
Okay. Yep. How's that?
Thank you.
Sure. You have a couple of handouts in your packets this evening that have more detailed information. My comments are going to be kept relatively high level, and if you have any questions, I can answer them after that. Safe Routes to School is a comprehensive program to increase the number of children who safely walk and bicycle to school through infrastructure improvements, thoughtful planning, and educational and promotional activities. MnDOT coordinates and leverages resources with partners statewide, including the Minnesota Departments of Health and Education, statewide nonprofits like the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota and the American Heart Association, cities and counties, and regional planning and transportation staff. Our partners support the development and implementation of the Statewide Resource Center with training and evaluation tools, walking and bicycling safety curriculum, bicycle fleets, safe routes to school plans and engineering analysis, and walk and bike to school day events. Since 2005, MnDOT has awarded more than $39 million in federal and state funds to Minnesota communities for safe routes to school, reaching more than 1,500 schools and over 720,000 students. We know safe routes to school can help get kids moving, reduce the risk of injury, and improve vehicle congestion and air quality around our schools. Safe Routes has many benefits to Minnesota and our communities, and currently less than 1% of the state transportation budget is dedicated to it. Demand across the state is growing. In 2015, grant applications exceeded funding by 3-1. MnDOT knows there is demand for funding to help make walking and bicycling to school easier. Additional infrastructure funding helps support a Minnesota where all students can walk and bicycle on routes that are safe, comfortable, and convenient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dahlman. Do you find that there are more asks for money, for the grant money, than there were when it started?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I can specifically specify if requests have grown. I know as the program has been, as we've seen it over time and as it's been more established, we certainly have communities that expect to see solicitations, and we also, through our planning, have seen more requests for implementation and infrastructure funds.
Okay, and what's a normal kind of grant?
So the Safe Routes to School program does infrastructure and non-infrastructure funding. Specifically, this would be looking at infrastructure funding, is my understanding. And through our planning process, the infrastructure needs that are usually identified are things that help, for example, increase the safety of crossing for students to school. So looking at safer crosswalks or curb extensions that might shorten a crossing distance, or installing a sidewalk. For example, some of our schools are built outside of city limits, and there may not be a facility for students to walk or bicycle, and so there have been projects related to that as well.
Any other questions? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. Minnesota's got a pretty amazing history with this Safe Route to School Act. I believe Congressman Obastar was really involved in starting it nationwide, but I challenge all of us as members to look around our districts, because it's likely that there's probably one by a school that you don't even know about, or something, if you checked in your school districts. And the other thing just to consider is it's not how, I mean, yes, it's focused on kids in schools, but people that are mobility challenged also have difficulty moving around on our sidewalks. So it's thinking about how the curbs are, you know, smooth and transitioned better. So it's that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good point. Thank you very much. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that point, too, if the testifier could just provide us with a link to understand if we have any in our district, that'd be great.
Madam Chair and representatives, thank you for the question and the comments. I'm actually thrilled to say that we do have a map on our website that we can certainly provide you that shows where funding has happened statewide since the inception of the program in 2005, and so it shows where we've funded planning assistance grants. It shows where we've funded bicycle fleets. It shows where we've trained teachers and staff to implement curriculum, and it shows where we've had infrastructure projects as well, and you can sort it by legislative district.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
And they have good grand openings.
That's true.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dahlman. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair and representatives, thank you.
Representative Juergens, House File 2354.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back in 2017, I worked out an agreement with MnDOT to take a look at a roadway in Hastings, Highway State Highway 316. It's about a mile in length. It's an unsafe road. And so MnDOT, over the course of the last year and year and a half, has worked with the residents of the area, has worked with the city of Hastings, and has come up with a new roadway plan. What this bill is asking for is funding for the trail portion of that road. This stretch of highway is on the Mississippi River Trail, and it's part of the Great River Road. And the bill is asking for about $2.5 million in trail funding, but in consultation with nonpartisan staff, Mr. Lee informed me that about $1 million would be bondable. So I just saved you $1.5 million on your bill. I will cut that down to $1 million even. And I have Nick Egger, the Director of Public Works from the City of Hastings, here for testimony.
Mr. Egger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity tonight. I'll just be brief. As Representative Juergens mentioned, the city and MnDOT have been working in partnership since 2017 to work through a public involvement process, gathering feedback from our community and technical experts on issues that are along this one-mile corridor of Highway 316 in Hastings. And overwhelmingly, we heard back from those interactions with people that safety was a big concern. And so we've developed an array of solutions to address that in working through the final design. Among them, the project would feature three new compact mini roundabouts that would serve as traffic calming and access management improvement. We would have trails that would go alongside each side of the highway corridor and interconnect existing parts of the trail system. This is, again, along the MRT, which is a major nationwide trail system from Minnesota, the headwaters in Mississippi, all the way down to New Orleans. Also, among the features would be safer pedestrian crossings and some access management improvements. So all told, these features are the right solution for the problems that were identified by the public. The Hastings City Council did adopt a resolution in support of this layout and concept. And at this current state, as we work through the final design with MnDOT, we have a funding gap in place, and so the funding that's being requested through Representative Juergens' legislation that he's offered would assist greatly in closing that gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eggers. A roundabout?
That's not part of this funding. That's part of the overall project.
Okay, yes. And the roundabout isn't part of the trail.
Correct.
Right?
Yes, the trail system would be on either side of the roadway.
And
the roundabout is
the trail
the
walkers and bikers wouldn't be going around in the roundabout. Or would they?
They have to cross at these intersections where the roundabouts would be featured, yes.
Okay.
Just like any other common intersection that you'd find.
Representing?
Madam Chair, as I look closely at the diagrams, it appears that the trails begin and end actually at the crosswalks.
The trail system, the extensions would begin up near the northern end of the corridor, near the intersection junction with Highway 61, and extend all the way down to the southern city limits, interconnecting with other pieces of trail that are already in place.
Okay, so what I'm looking at is actually just the boulevard where it starts and stops. So this is disconnected in some ways from the trail, except at those areas where they may cross at the crosswalks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Correct.
And currently with the, like as we both said, the Mississippi River Trail, there is no trail there. That is just along the roadway where there's very little shoulder, and there's ditches on either side, so it is a unsafe area.
Do you think there would be increased numbers of people with the trail, using the trail?
There would be increased number of pedestrian users on the trails for sure, both from the neighborhoods in that area and kids getting to parks. And with part of the traffic calming that Mr. Egger talked about, we're actually hoping that it would decrease the amount of truck traffic and other vehicle traffic on the roadway. But, yeah, we would expect to see a great increase in the pedestrian traffic as a result of this.
Okay. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to ask this question. I drove through Hastings one time wandering down to Red Wing, and I don't think I was intending to drive that way, and I became absolutely sure of that when I drove down a narrow urban road. Is that what this is?
Very possible.
I mean, it was a horrible condition road, and this is like extraordinarily almost emergency relative to what I drove on.
Yeah, that would be the roadway. This was a logging road over 100 years ago, and the town grew up around it. And it's a state highway right now, but it's residential. There's commercial on one side of the road. There's residential on the other. Yeah. It needs some serious attention. And this is what we're asking, again, from the bonding, is just a part of the puzzle. The MnDOT was already planning a mill and overlay on that stretch of road. And so what we're trying to do is turn this into to use the funding that was available for that and then expand it. And we're looking at multiple sources for funding. This is just one of them. We're trying to piece as much of it together as we can.
And is this on the MnDOT list to do in the next 2-3 years?
Yes, this project is programmed for 2021.
And this gives it a head start, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Juergens. So the council is in favor of this, you mentioned earlier?
That's correct.
Thank you, Representative Juergens.
The resolution.
So I've had the opportunity to do one of these long rides across the country, and I imagine people definitely want to do the Mississippi route. But I'm looking at your map, and I'm not sure that people are going to go into the neighborhood like that if they're really doing a cross country or across, you know. Anyways, I know you're mean well. I know the corridor very well. It's actually north of there by the dairy. Things are moving very fast, but I don't know. It just doesn't. I'm not sure how you'll have to figure out how to really get riders off the road.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lilly. You're right. It is part of the bigger puzzle and the bigger trail system, but that is the one of the routes if you are intending to ride, for example, to Red Wing.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Representative Juergens, do you ever drive on this road?
No.
I'm just kidding. I'm trying to get them for earlier.
No. I do, and I always set the cruise control because I don't want to get picked up for speeding there. That's the biggest issue that residents have is that people speed through there, and I think it would look bad if I got picked up for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Representative Erdahl, House File 2607 for McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm pinch hitting for Representative McDonald tonight. I did have the pleasure of representing Annandale the first 10 years of my service here in the legislature. Then in 2012 with redistricting, the district upgraded to Representative McDonald. Now, I know we're not doing amendments, but were I to do one tonight...
You have one.
I would change the amount from $5,317,000 to $4,753,000.
Why would you do that, Representative Erdolph or McDonald?
Because they told me to. There's less cost, I guess, if we need to get into specifics of why it's less. The mayor here would be able to do that. But what we have is a project in the city of Annandale. We have two trunk highways, 24 and 55, that are having projects on them, entailing street, storm, sanitary infrastructure improvements that need to be made in connection with these highway improvements. And so if Annandale has to finance this themselves, the cost, without help from the state, they would have a lot of difficulty. And they're already on the edge in a lot of different categories as to what the state would approve of in terms of spending. But with that, I do have the mayor of Annandale, Mayor Gunnarsson, with me, and he could give you some more information and answer some questions.
Mayor Gunnarsson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in House File 2607. My name is Dwight Gunnarsson, and I am the mayor of Annandale. House File 2607 would provide $4.75 million in state resources with an equal amount matched by the city of Annandale for critical street, sewer, and water infrastructure improvements. Between now and 2022, MnDOT has scheduled two major trunk highway projects within our community. The first is the reconstruction of Trunk Highway 55, and the second is the reconstruction of Trunk Highway 24, both of which intersect in the economic heart of our community, which is our downtown. In order to reduce costs to taxpayers and to reduce stress on our businesses, residents, and community as a whole, now is the appropriate and logical time to replace our 100-year-old water, sewer, and storm infrastructure within these MnDOT projects. If we fail to time these projects to occur at the same time, then it won't be long before we are forced to dig up these same roads to service our city infrastructure, which only adds to more cost, more burden on our residents, most of which will rightfully question why we are digging up brand new MnDOT roads. Under normal circumstances, we would accept this burden as our responsibility. Unfortunately, we don't face normal circumstances. In a matter of 3 years, the city of Annandale will face two major MnDOT projects within our community, doubling our needs to step up. In addition, in recent years, our community replaced our wastewater treatment facility due to improved state water quality standards. As a result of our investment in this project, our debt per capita increased to more than $4,800. As credit rating agencies categorize $5,000 in debt per capita as high, our credit rating has been downgraded, which makes the cost of our borrowing higher. And frankly, we are limited in the amount of debt that we can responsibly take on. We were also recently informed that within the next decade, we will need to make additional investments in our wastewater facility to bring it up to the new state water quality standards, which we are currently analyzing how we can best handle this coming infrastructure need. If the city must finance 100% of the cost of these projects, without the help of the state, it will result in a dramatic increase in local taxes and fees. We will need to increase our local property taxes 42%, increase our storm sewer rates 152%, increase water rates 15%, and increase sanitary sewer rates 5%, which are already 35% higher than the high end of the affordability standards used by the state and federal governments. Now, I know you have a significant number of capital investment requests before this committee this year, and each one is important and worthy, but I think you will be hard-pressed to find another community in the state that faces our same predicament. Two major MnDOT projects happening back-to-back, local infrastructure needs that are most appropriate, appropriately and cost-effectively done in conjunction with the state projects, and in a community that lacks the borrowing capacity because of our recent investment in our wastewater infrastructure, to make sure that we are living up to the water quality expectations of the state and our residents. Thank you for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions you or the committee may have at this time.
And with you, you have former chair.
This guy right here.
We're so pleased to welcome you to the bonding committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Dorman, representing the city of Annandale. Really have nothing additional to add, but there's no possible way I would miss the opportunity to appear before your committee.
Thank you very much. And next week, I would like to arrange a conversation with you.
I will be happy
about our former experience on the Capital Investment Committee.
Happy to do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mayor, do you have a relationship with the Public Facilities Authority?
I do not. Oh, are you talking about PFA?
For your city?
Yeah, PFA.
Okay, yes. We have applied for financing, correct.
And you're on their list somewhere?
We are.
Because with the wastewater stuff and a grant or the...
Yes, we are because of their timing requirements.
Okay.
We've had to get on that.
Madam Chair, I believe, from what I've been told, that they are on for the Highway 24 project, that the PFA has a pending qualification for them there, and the other one has yet to be done.
Okay. And I don't quite understand the problem with the two. Were the two MnDOT programs together in the same place?
They just happen to be coming right at the same place. They're two different projects.
And it was over what time period?
Over the next 3 years.
Okay. And did they give you a reason why one couldn't be done and then the other one started?
We received no reason. They just told us this is when they were doing these projects.
And what kind of warning did they give you ahead of time?
Well, I guess we've known about these projects. They came on our radar within the past 2 years is when they started to talk about these projects and do their initial designs.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're going back to Representative Dabney, 521.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your flexibility in going back and forth in your agenda.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, those of you who were here in 2018 may recall that the bonding bill last year included $25 million in the cash portion of the bill for school safety initiatives. In response to that $25 million, school districts across the state assessed safety concerns in their buildings and replied to the Minnesota Department of Education with, I believe it was $285 million in requests. So in short, the $25 million fell far short of the need identified by school districts across the state. So, Madam Chair, you asked if these projects, at the beginning of the evening, if the projects individuals were representing were shovel-ready. These were a year ago, so they certainly are now. With me tonight is Ms. Cheryl Polson, a member of the Wayzata School Board.
Okay. Ms. Polson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Polzine, and I'm currently serving my eighth year on the Wayzata School Board. I'm also in my third year serving on the Minnesota School Boards Association Board of Directors. I'm a parent and a community member who, like each member here, is very concerned and cares deeply about the safety of students. School safety has been a high priority for the legislature. School boards, parents, and students do to the continued tragic school threats and shootings across the country. These events have changed how Minnesota defines school safety, and for that reason, I join the other 331 school boards across the state in support of House File 521. To put this bill in context, the 2018 legislature funded the school safety grant program in the bonding bill with $25 million to help address some of the communication and facility needs in our school buildings. 1,187 schools applied for the grant program. MDE awarded just 123 grants to improve school building safety. What is disturbing is 1,064 school buildings, 90% of the applicants did not receive funding. School buildings that were identified, qualified, and quantified with needs totaling $255 million. With this type of response from school districts, the legislature should react with urgency. School safety should continue to be a high priority and equitably funded across the state. Because the need greatly eclipsed the dollars assigned to this program last year, there were some unintended consequences that have emerged. The awarding of grants to only certain schools has highlighted the fact that districts with non-awarded schools must now choose between simply going without the safety measures deemed necessary or taking the funds from an already strapped budget, compromising other existing programs. We should be striving to decrease inequities in education funding, not exacerbate them. Another unintended consequence is the potential for inequities within individual districts. The 2018 safety grants were awarded on a building level, and many districts submitted several applications for similar projects in numerous buildings. If one project was awarded and the others were not, districts now are grappling with how to ensure equity across the district in their different buildings. While school districts and the public appreciate last year's legislative efforts to address school safety and security, I believe we have all learned that the 2018 $25 million grant program was woefully underfunded. This bill, House File 521, will help bring equity and safety to our schools. It is more critical now than before, and we ask you to include it in your 2019 bonding bill. So thank you, Chair Dabney, for bringing this bill forward, and I encourage committee members to support it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
No, my question is of Representative Dabney. When you had your meeting about your budget target, did they include an amount of money for the safe schools?
There is conversation about increasing the safe schools levy, yes. If I'm understanding Madam Chair's question correctly.
But they didn't say spend $100 million on safe schools for the safe school grants.
Madam Chair, while I received a number of stipulations for from leadership, that was not amongst the stipulations, no.
And I did not receive conversation or money for safe school grants. So if you don't have money and I don't have money,
Madam
what's
Chair,
the message to the school districts?
That the Capital Investment Committee has a target that hopefully is inclusive of additional safe schools grants. You know, Madam Chair, as a retired teacher yourself, you know that every day is a new day and one for hope in Minnesota schools.
I know we might both have conversations in the future, in the future days.
I would welcome that, Madam Chair, for instance.
Any other questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dabney. Just keep in mind that, you know, potentially these are two separate pots of money here. Last time, you know, the K-12 Education Committee appropriated money for school safety, but the Capital Investment Committee appropriated money also for school safety, but ours are for capital-type projects, for bricks-and-mortar-type things. And, you know, that likely is still the case here. The focus of the money that you would fund would be different from what we would do.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, correct. And the discussions in my committee this year have included things like the school safety levy, which can be used for people in schools, counselors and the like. Also, I know there's been discussion of the Support Our Students grants, which were done previously, which again are is a grant program to incent districts to hire school counselors, social workers, nurses, and psychologists. There's also, as I indicated, been some conversation about expanding the school Safe Schools levy, which can be used both for some bricks and mortar sort of things as well as for staff. Because really it's a multifaceted approach. It is about making sure that the building is secure for a whole host of reasons, that you can lock the doors, that the windows are secure, that you've got the video monitors where they're needed so that the office can monitor who's coming into the building and the like. It's also about people.
And Madam Chair, just one further quick comment. The money that was in the K-12 last time, of course, was vetoed mm-hmm. as part of the larger bill at the end, and you know the bonding money did get through and was spent. But I would hope that perhaps you can still go back to leadership and remind them that that money was there last year, I believe $25 million, and perhaps they can still make some adjustments to at least include that much in what you have.
Thank you.
Ms. Deason, could you refresh our minds on how that $25 million cash for the grants from last year, when that appeared and how it came about? Because Ms. Nash has reminded me that Department of Budget Management doesn't really like bonding for that. So how did it turn into $25 million of cash? And at what point in the whole process?
Madam Chair, I would have to go back to find out when it changed, but what I can do is forward to you the letter sent by Commissioner Franz last year that he has sent again this year on some other projects that the department has reservations about using bonds for school projects in general, whether it's for the school safety grants. And there was a lot of discussion about it last biennium, which is why it ended up as general fund appropriation for the $25 million. So in any case, I can forward to you the letter that the commissioner sent last year with his objections to using bond funds for this purpose.
Thank you. And any other questions? We will continue the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Offline, as they say.
As they say. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Nornes, 2626. Mr. Kerr. Sounds like a Fergus Falls issue here coming up.
It is, Madam Chair.
Representative.
I don't know if this is proper or not, but I was going to put a plug in. We talked museums earlier this evening.
Yes.
We've got a World War II museum and a Civil War museum in my district, just so you know.
Thank you.
Yes. Tonight, however, 2626 is dealing with the National Guard Readiness Center, located in Fergus Falls. It's 63 years old and has had very little done for 63 years. So we're here to ask for some help. $2,195,000 will take care of the problem. So I have as a testifier tonight Don Kerr, and he will tell you the rest of the story.
Thank you. Mr. Kerr, you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. And, Madam Chair, this is one of the projects that was also included in a governor's bonding bill. We do appreciate Representative Norma's carrying it as a standalone, and we think it's a very worthy project, and I want to talk about some of the details. He did mention that $2.195 million is the requested amount. That will be matched dollar for dollar with federal funding. It is not a shovel-ready project. In fact, we intend to execute this project in 2021. And I know the committee may be thinking, well, then this can wait a year or two. But I would like to argue and make you aware that one of the real advantages that we have in gaining additional federal funding is having state funding in hand for these types of projects. It gives us tremendous leverage with the National Guard Bureau to get additional funding that we may not otherwise have gotten at all, and certainly allows us to get it sooner than we may otherwise have done so. So I really hope you strongly consider adding this project in the current bonding bill so that we have that leverage with the federal government. As Representative Nornis mentioned, the facility is 63 years old. It'll be 65 years old by the time we do the renovation, and we think this will buy us another 30 years in the facility, at which point we'll have to make a decision about whether we're going to replace it or do another renovation to it. But we see this as a long-term location for the National Guard, and we think it's a very important project. It is our outstate project of the two that we have, and we think that's also very important to consider. And with that, I'll subject myself to any questions the committee may have.
What happens if the project, after it's planned for, is cheaper?
Madam Chair, we have put language in the bill, and we like to do this, that if by chance the project does come in below and there's additional bond proceeds available, with notification to the Commissioner of Management and Budget, we would be allowed to use those for statewide asset preservation and other armories around the state. And that helps work down our backlog. We're carrying a very large maintenance backlog, as all state agencies are, but this is in line with our comprehensive plan to sustain our facilities and get in and do renovations about every 20 to 30 years in all of them.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just mentioned exactly what I was going to ask about is, could at some point, could we view the long-term plan relative to the increments of how these planned expenditures, because having been in the National Guard, I understand that none of this just happens and nobody just wakes up from a dream. So this is probably laid out for at least, as you said, 20 or 30 years in terms of knowing which units or which facilities are planned to be either closed and or allowed to retire.
Madam Chair, Representative Salk, I'd be happy to provide that information to the committee. And yes, we do have a very long-range plan, and we do adjustments to it every couple of years based on which of our projects we're able to complete based on federal funding for replacement facilities and that sort of thing.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lissigard, House File 2655. Sorry you had to wait so long.
Oh, my pleasure. So thank you. This has been a labor of love, and it's one of these projects that the East Range communities have been working on for several years. And here with me today is the new mayor of Aurora to talk through this project.
What happened to the old mayor of Aurora?
He's sitting in front of you, too.
Oh. Yeah. Welcome, Mr. New Mayor.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Those are big shoes to fill, but I'm trying the best I can. So the project in question here, the City of Aurora, in cooperation with the City of Biwabik, the City of Hoyt Lakes, and the adjacent town of White, are requesting $6 million in additional state bond funding to acquire land, design and construct a new water source pumping installation, build a new water treatment plant, and install new distribution infrastructure to interconnect this new facility with the four communities' existing water distribution lines. The total estimated cost for the project is $17.2 million. Currently, these cities each own and operate their own water supply, treatment plants, and distribution systems, with the town of White being served by the City of Aurora's water system. Each of the water systems individually are facing significant near-term and long-range challenges. And to address these mounting challenges, the potential for a joint water system has been planned and evaluated for over 8 years. This is no spur-of-the-moment idea by any means. As a result of all those deliberations, it's been determined that a new system at the nearby and centrally located Embarrass Lake mine pit will better serve the needs of the four communities than four separate systems. The new combined water system would serve an area that's roughly 6 miles wide and covers approximately 48 square miles. Now, in your handout materials, I believe on the second page, you have a map of the project area and kind of moving from west to east along this east range area. The city of Biwabik on the westerly fringe currently uses the Canton mine pit on its north side as its source for drinking water. Due to changes in the mining operations of the nearby ArcelorMittal mining company and some natural fluctuation experiences in the water levels of that Canton pit, both the city of Biwabik and ArcelorMittal have determined that the city should relocate its source for drinking water to the nearby Embarrass pit. Moving further east, the city of Aurora and the town of White currently use the St. James mine pit located along the north edge of the city of Aurora as their source of drinking water. Their existing water intake facility is in danger of becoming submerged by rising pit water levels and needs major improvements in order to continue supplying the quality of drinking water and fire protection capacities needed to serve their communities. And then on the far west end of this chain of cities and townships, the city of Hoyt Lakes currently uses its adjacent Colby Lake as its source for drinking water, and their existing facility will also require additional improvement and need major renovations in the future. So, since at least 2011, the four communities have been meeting to discuss various options for their envisioned joint water system. The communities, through the East Range Joint Powers Board, of which they're all members, have been successful in recent years in acquiring sufficient funds to start preliminary planning and design for this new system. And the new system would include a new common and centrally located water intake and treatment plant located on Town of White owned land that's along the southwest shore of the Embarrass mine pit, which you can see in the diagram with the arrow is centrally located between all these communities, with a system of new distribution lines that would connect to the existing distribution systems of each one and pressurization facilities. Now, in the course of planning the proposed joint systems, each individual community and the new target site already have been evaluated for water quality, conditions of existing facilities, water treatment alternatives, and community interconnections. The project itself is proposed to have two separate phases. The initial phase would address the city of Aurora and town of White, and possibly also the city of Biwabik's water supply needs. A later phase would include the city of Hoyt Lakes and, if still necessary, the city of Biwabik. The preliminary plans for the new system allow for a modular expansion, which is seems to be a prudent way to approach it, for the new intake and treatment facilities and capacities in each case. The existing independently owned and operated water intake facilities will be abandoned, but to the extent feasible anyway, we're certainly going to try to use all of the water distribution systems within each community. So in summary, the completion of the project is really vital. The communities have responsibly and collectively spent an enormous amount of time planning for this project, and it's vital in so many ways. It meets all the foreseeable water quality standards that any of our advisors or communities could envision. It utilizes a higher quality of water, which you know is a concern on the mining areas, thus resulting in less extensive treatment costs. It achieves economies of scale that couldn't be achieved by any one of the communities. It assures an abundant supply of this high-quality water to meet all foreseeable needs of these four combined communities. It facilitates, obviously, economic development of the member communities. And most importantly, I think, it provides just another opportunity to enable the member communities to work more closely together, and a goal that, at least in all my experience in the state, has been often talked about, seldom achieved. And it's an opportunity to create that vision or fulfill it, as they're now doing, as we now have been doing through our joint East Range Joint Powers Board and some other joint emergency services. So I respectfully, on behalf of the partnership, essentially these four committees, ask for your financial support for the project and invite any questions you have about it.
Mayor Greger, what is your relationship with the Public Facilities Authority?
We have applications and standing within the Public Facilities Authorities. I think our rating number is fairly high, four or five, I believe, someplace in that area.
And did you apply to them as the joint powers or individual? Is that Aurora?
Well, the city of Aurora, the city's been leading this project up to this point, but we are envisioning forming another joint powers entity and would hope that that entity would assume the central responsibilities for the project.
Questions? Representative Lehman.
I don't have a question so much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to greet my friend Doug Greger.
Thank you.
It's good to see you here, and I can see you have totally, you're doing a great job as mayor.
Well.
Doug Greger gave me great legal advice over the course of many, many years related to the IRRB. And somehow the city of Aurora seems to be able to attract great, talented people in their mayors, so welcome.
Madam Chair, it was a personal privilege to be able to provide legal advice to an individual who actually listened to it so well.
Representative Lissigard,
yes.
You have another guest?
No, she is our city administrator, or the city of Aurora's administrator, and answer any questions you may have.
Oh, okay. And please introduce her to us. Yes.
Becky Lammy.
Becky Lammy, City Administrator, City of Aurora.
Thank you. Any questions? No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Moving on to House File 2028, Representative Bohm. Second time up here.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'd also like to thank my co-authors for House File 2028, Representative Morrison and Representative Erdahl. So House File 2028 would provide $728,000 to the city of Chanhassen for improvements to a 1.7-mile stretch of Lyman Boulevard, thereby changing a two-lane rural road to a safer urban roadway. Currently, we have no curbs, very little shoulders, and a lot of subsiding soils. We also have the brand new Chanhassen High School located at the east end of this 1.7-mile stretch. And that gives us a fair amount of new, less experienced drivers and cars, as well as a fair amount of school bus traffic. In addition, the surrounding neighborhoods have quite a bit of commercial light industrial development. So that brings a lot of cars to the street, as well as a fair amount of truck traffic, bringing in supplies and carrying out finished products. So suffice to say, it's a very busy road. This is the last portion of funding needed for this $6.6 million project. And I believe this project is a shining example of collaboration with the three partners, Carver County, the City of Chaska, and the City of Chanhassen, working together and bringing dollars to the table to bring this exciting project to fruition. So here with me tonight is the city manager from Chanhassen, Todd Gearhart, to give you an overview of this exciting proposed project.
Okay.
Thank you.
Before that happens, Carver County, Chanhassen, and?
And the city of Chaska.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Bowe, Madam Chair, and committee members. Just to give you an orientation on the map that's in front of you, you notice a red line on that map. Highway 41 and Lyman is already funded through Carver County and a grant through MnDOT to upgrade 41 with a roundabout, eliminating a temporary signal that's been there for 25 years. So I just wanted to make sure you understood the map. So this is everything east of the red line is $6.6 million. Again, I'm the city manager for the city of Chanhassen. As Representative Bowe said, the city is requesting $728,000 in GO bonds for a shovel-ready project. It's a one-mile section of Lyman Boulevard that connects Chanhassen High School to State Highway 41, a major north-south arterial connecting State Highway to Highway 5 and 212. Lyman Boulevard runs through the heart of a growing business district and serves not only schools, buses, and students, but an increasing number of commercial vehicles. The road needs to be upgraded from what is a rural two-lane highway and to an urban section with curb, gutter, and roundabouts. This is the last phase of the upgrade of Lyman Boulevard and will consist of a total reconstruction of the roadway with the addition of two roundabouts at Peavey Road and Norax Drive and removing the existing traffic signal at State Highway 41. And the stop signs at Norax and PD Road with many roundabouts. The total cost of this project is $6.8 million. $2.2 million is expected from Chanhassen. That's why we're asking for the $728,000 because we are short, have a financial shortfall in our state aid amount to reach that dollar amount. Chaska is contributing 1.4, Carver County is contributing 3.2 million. And Chanhassen High School attendance areas include students from Carver, Victoria, and Chanhassen. Easterly Carver County school districts, the Chaska High School is primarily all of Chaska High School students. Chanhassen High School enrollment includes Carver County, or the City of Carver, City of Victoria, and the City of Chanhassen. Families from Victoria that attend Chanhassen High School are currently using Lyman as their access route to the new high school. Chanhassen High School has an enrollment of over 800 students and traveled from Chanhassen, Victoria, and Carver, who use a variety of roadways to access the high school. But one primary access point will be State Highway 41 and Lyman Boulevard. The City of Chanhassen has provided approved approximately 400,000 square feet of office industrial located on the old Halasic greenhouse property. This site is directly across from Lyman Boulevard and will have direct access onto Lyman. And construction is proposed to start in 2019 and expected to employ over 500 employees. Avienda is a future regional housing and office development designation that has also has access off of Lyman Boulevard, Powers Boulevard, U.S. Highway 212, and the development will draw customers from State Highway 41 via Lyman Boulevard to access this site. Construction on the Avienda project will also start in the spring of 2019 and is over 500,000 square feet. Chanhassen has contributed the max amount of its municipal state aid, that is the city's portion of the sales tax that we receive for state aid highways, which leaves us with a gap of $728,000 in our funding. On behalf of the Chanhassen Mayor and City Council, we appreciate you listening to our testimony, and we are open to any questions that you may have.
Mr. Gerhard, what's the population of Tanhassen?
We're roughly 25,000.
Do you receive local government aid?
No, we do not.
How many roundabouts are in this whole total program?
Well, in the project that we're talking about would be at Peavy and Norax Drive. Carver County received a grant for $2.2 million, which is separate of this, but we want to join this project to have one large project and start have it shovel-ready by spring of 2019. So there's three roundabouts, two with the project that we're requesting, one that is with MnDOT and Carver County.
One with MnDOT and one with Carver County?
Correct, right on State Highway
40. So there's 40. Five roundabouts?
Nope. One that is supported by Carver County and MnDOT, and two by the two cities in Carver County, so a total of three.
But, Madam Chair, those roundabouts are sprouting all over the place.
Oh, they certainly are, and I'm just not sure who's suggesting these roundabouts all the time. Well, it's like seeds, I guess, that just spreads and spreads.
Madam Chair, people get frustrated when they sit at stoplights and have to wait when there's no cars around them. The opportunity of a roundabout allows you to keep moving.
I know, I understand that, and I understand when an engineer or a county director of highways or something is talking about them, they always say, it's a calming thing.
I can't disagree
with
you.
I'm a great student of roundabouts. You might have caught on by this time.
Yes.
And sometimes I'm not so calm. When you go around more than once, you know, how calm can you be? When you're going right and you want to go left, how calm can you be? My gosh!
Madam Chair,
anyway, I know that roundabouts are calming and they slow traffic where a drive slow sign couldn't possibly do the trick. Or a stop sign where you wait your turn couldn't possibly get you through as fast. No, it's a wonderful invention, those roundabouts are. Are these complete roundabouts or are they mini roundabouts? I heard that term twice tonight.
Madam Chair, there's two mini roundabouts and one large roundabout.
So there's a roundabout for everyone in this project.
Just for you.
Thank you for the joy that you have brought into my life this evening. Questions? Representative Erdahl.
Madam Chair, just a comment in terms of calming effect. You are lucky that you weren't in the car with me the first time I encountered a roundabout. I was in Tennessee, and I went to the left.
Uh-oh.
It was not calming.
It's interesting. We'll get used to it.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I believe they still talk about you in Tennessee yet to this day.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a very important project to our district. We appreciate your time this evening. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler, House File 2707, 2708.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing these.
Welcome.
Shall we start with 2708?
Okay.
And this bill has two different major components, but the first of it is a heart of the government, as I might refer to it, campus plan. focused on the decision-making constitutional offices and their needs. So it focuses on the tunnel-connected buildings. We understand that the Department of Administration has a big plan in front of you for over $1 million to look at all the state agencies in Minneapolis and St. Paul and downtown and the Capitol Complex. This might be considered a component of it. But it is to make sure that our decision-making entities are really involved integratively in the planning. Because I have learned something in my 14 years here. Some of you have been involved with me over the long haul to restore the Capitol. And while we all celebrated the wonderful hundreds of millions of dollars that resulted in our restored Capitol, some of you may not know or remember that there was another Capitol preservation plan that was done before that was dead-ended. The Department of Administration hired these knowledgeable consultants from other states, and they came in and they worked over an election year's summer. They said, well, we tried to get a hold of a few of you, but you were very busy. And so they came up with on their own this wonderful plan, and it went thud because the people who were impacted and the needs of the public and the needs of the state agencies that use our building with us in partnership and the needs of the lobbyists, all of that got theoretically addressed instead of in partnership with the people who are from Minnesota and know our buildings and how we interact. And so I have learned that while our state agencies are wonderful and talented, they and their consultants can't just go off and do good things and expect that it's going to work for those of us who serve the public. And so this directs that the Department of Administration would work with all of us and all of the constitutional officers in developing an assessment of our current needs and what might better serve the public. And, for example, before the Capitol was renovated, I asked the information desk, what are your top three questions? Number one, where are the bathrooms? We solved that. We put a lot more in. Number two, where do we park? Well, we put in parking around the side, but you don't park out front anymore. And number three was, where do I register my business? They would daily get people who were so excited to finally get that business plan into reality, and they were disappointed to find out that the office that they register and pay to make their business plan official wasn't on the Capitol campus. Maybe we should think about that when we do a plan. That's the kind of thing that I think the participants and the agencies can bring to the table. And so I'm glad to work with administration and how they're going to do their gigantic plan. But I think for those of us who serve the public, our needs are not being met. 134 people serve in this building. We have four conference rooms that can serve 10 to 12, 16 people. We have two floors half empty, but we're not allowed to go into that and even set up a conference room. We can do better. And so that's the first part. The second part also says that in looking at this, they're going to look at one of the most beautiful and under and unused buildings on our campus that the legislature has historically and on preserved, which is the Ford Building. And if you're not familiar with the Ford Building, it's the beautiful white and red brick building on University Avenue right by the light rail stop. It's connected to us by tunnel and eligible for historic national designation the last time we looked at it. And as in 2004, the Department of Administration has proposed demolishing it, and then they wanted to do it for parking ramp. That was rejected in law by the legislature, and instead they created a Ford Building Commission to analyze the options. And I didn't bring you the whole report, but I did give you an excerpt from the report. And it looks how it summarizes the page I gave you, has a summary of a analysis that was done, contracted by the Department of Administration, to LHB Engineers and Architects, CPMI in Bloomington, Minnesota, and Arthur Pierce of Ithaca, New York, whose summary was, after looking at tearing it down, preserving it, and it was still closed at that time, was upgrades and repairs of the exterior envelope are should be made. Interior reservation will provide a work environment that is more efficient, sustainable, and comfortable, and it is the most cost-effective scenario for the state to consider and pursue. And your handout shows you the seven different scenarios, and it was much cheaper even to expand the existing building with a new building surrounding it than to tear it down and start new. And, of course, our greenest building is the building that currently exists. It is so solid. It's 12-inch thick walls and 12-inch thick floors and was even back then designated for a green roof. And we feel that it's time for the legislature to once again step up and preserve this building. There's some history and other information in your packet. But we think the reason it wasn't rehabbed after that was because the recommendation was it would be swing space for the senators while we closed off each wing of the Capitol and renovated it. The senators didn't like the idea of being moved out of this Capitol. The plan to renovate the Capitol one wing at a time went thud, as I said, and until the new Senate office building was ready and occupied and happily serving senators, there was not an opportunity for us to reinvest in the Ford buildings, which is why I'm bringing it forward. And I think it's time now to step forward. With that, I will conclude. Paul Mandel is here from the Capitol Area Architectural and Planning Board to speak to their support.
Mr. Mandel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Mandel, Executive Secretary for the Capitol Area Architectural and Planning Board. And just one side note on item on Section 1B, the part that is reserved for approval of the by the Capitol Preservation Commission, just for your information, all those issues that are presented in that section already go before the Cap Board for review and approval. And we have four legislators on our board. We meet actually far more often than the Preservation Commission. And we were created by the legislature to report to the legislature. So that's just a side piece of information for the committee. Our long-range plan, and we're currently halfway through a three-year plan, comprehensive planning effort, but our long-range plan calls for at least the serious reconsideration of reuse of the Ford Building, if not the incorporation of the Ford Building, into a larger floor plate that would fill the rest of the block with a state building fronting completely on University Avenue. It is our belief that the building is structurally sound. The side, the exteriors are falling apart on the two sides. The historic front is still pretty stable with the exception of the cornice, but we have toured it repeatedly and we believe the building is structurally sound. One of our architects that went through it recently thought, if they tried to dynamite the building, it'd be one of these cases where you got a puff of smoke and nothing happened. It was used as a vertical assembly plant for the Ford. There are something like 20 or 25 Ford buildings. One was just rehabbed across from Target Field. Most of them are still standing and repurposed and reused. So they were built solidly. They took cars on all the floors, so they're structurally sound. Rather than end up with just the church on that whole area surrounded by parking, we would like to see the Ford Building incorporated into a future state building. I stand for any questions then.
Questions? Representative Pearson.
You know, Representative Loeffler and I have this long history of just bipartisan agreement on virtually everything. Thank you for that. One person in the room knows that I'm being sarcastic, but on this one, I really think you've hit a home run, and I really would like to see that building restored. Again, I think the access to the tunnel, the existing design, the actual incorporation of the style, and the fact that it is virtually of the identical era of the Capitol building itself, lend it to being a historical landmark that should definitely be incorporated, at least incorporated in future design and planning for the campus. So thanks for bringing the bill.
Thank you.
Anything else? Anyone else? Representative Torkelson.
More dynamite.
Madam Chair, one thing I forgot to mention was we also had extensive input from the surrounding community, and they were very excited about that building being relivened, and they found out that 2,500 square feet of it can be used for a public-private purpose because it was bond-funded, and they have been dreaming ever since of that nice coffee shop that we would put into their community as part of the restoration. I have heard from at least one member of the public, Brian McCann, who's an expert on the history of the building, who I think provided some materials to your packet as well.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loeffler. Just the room in this building, the empty room, the room of a requirement that's upstairs, is that it's my understanding that the Senate still has control of that space on the first floor. Is that correct?
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, if we were to get into a discussion of who has control of what space in the Capitol, that would be a very long hearing today. But we
don't have time for
that. And that is why I put the Capitol Preservation Commission in here, because it is one place where we do bring together the governor, the courts, the Minnesota House, and the Minnesota Senate, and we make each other work together on a common vision. And one of the visions that we have not successfully achieved in the renovation was to have the second and third floor of the beautiful Capitol active all year round. And the original plan was to have some other staff uses on those floors that have now not taken place. And I think that part of our planning should be about whether we should revisit some ideas, like some of the joint commissions or staff maybe going there, so that our building has people using it on a daily basis in every floor and looking after that beautiful building.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
House File 2708 has been heard. How about House File 2707?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We won't take as long with this one.
Madam Chair, this one will not take as long. This is a bill that would direct the Department of Administration over the interim to address the ventilation in the hearing rooms of the state office building. And I'm not sure if that's the right amount, but I was told by one of our staff who've been here for a long time that there was an estimate of $50,000 a few years ago to just deal with the ventilation, which is out of these vents that everyone who's ever sat around the dais knows well about. The audience in general tells me they're quite comfortable, but in my committee I've had people say I have to leave to go upstairs to get my winter coat. I have sat in hearings in which women have been totally covered in brightly printed blankets. For now that spring is approaching, I have to give up my wool clothes and my many layers, and so I have gone out and bought oversized sweaters and other things that I can put over a lightweight spring outfit. And we think there is more than enough justification for us to be able to have a hearing room in which we can listen respectfully without thinking about how cold we are and how many minutes we have before we can run out of the room and grab something hot.
Representative Juergens.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know. I sit in here and I think it's hot most of the time, so I'm not sure if it's a ventilation issue or just a body temperature issue. But
Put in a bill.
But we're out of hearings.
Oh, yes. We're out of hearings. Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you very much.
House File 406. Representative Marquardt. $3 million.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Committee. So, House File 406 is a request for $3 million to build a museum for Becker County. And yesterday there were folks down, the executive director, Becky Mitchell, and a city council member, and another member from the business community were down yesterday. I told them not to come back today, so it's not like there isn't support. But this would cover $3 million of a $6.4 million overall project. It would be about 30,000 square feet. Becker County has committed $1 million to the project. The City of Detroit Lakes has committed $500,000. They are currently located in what was once a church that was built in 1957. Now, to try to sell this bill, I would say that 1957 was very old, but that's the year I was born, so it's really not that old, but for buildings it might be. The problems, though, it's got a leaky roof, there's mold. And do you have some handouts on this? Do they? Okay. So there's some pictures of that. There's an elevator that doesn't work, just a lack of space overall. So, you know, they have new leadership now, and some of the stats in there in the last 4 years, they've actually gone from a low of like 500 attendance for the entire year to 8,000 in just 4 years. So they've kind of renovated the interest for a museum in Becker County. But what this new facility would do, it would serve as a science and children's hands-on learning experience center. There'd be areas for oral recordings, multi-purpose spaces for students and educational opportunities, traveling exhibits. It would be fully accessible. One thing, as you can see by the designs, it actually would be attached to what's called the Holmes Theater in Detroit Lakes. It's a cultural arts theater center, so that would really work in conjunction with the museum. And finally, I'm going to kind of end on this and take questions, but this is for Representative Erdahl. You know, I teach social studies, and I've taught world history, I've taught U.S. history, I've taught Minnesota history. But the one history that really gets lost around the state is when you really get to local history. And it is those local museums that afford students that opportunity, because you're not going to find it in textbooks or anywhere else, but it's those museums that bring it to life. So this would certainly fill that niche in Becker County. It has great community support and certainly would enhance the culture and just the history of Becker County to students and folks around the county. So that's it, Madam Chair, and if there's questions and so forth.
What's the population of Becker County?
It's probably a little over 30,000.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have been in the Becker County Museum. I spoke there once on history. And it is an older structure, yes, it is. And also, when I was teaching, I taught a class called Local History, where it was kind of innovative for the time. We took the students out, probably a couple field trips a week, going to different areas around the county, and you know, teaching them local history.
Representative Erdahl, did you speak at the museum?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair.
I was very impressed with the new director of the museum, and her. I did make a statement at the time that she seemed to be the right woman at the right time because of the increased activity that the museum was undertaking. And she had great plans for all generations.
Madam Chair, Becky Mitchell is a visionary. She really has turned that around, mm-hmm. No doubt.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Appreciate
Representative
that.
Hamilton, House File 2660. Welcome, Representative Hamilton.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair.
Please begin.
All right, Madam Chair, House File 2660 addresses the tunnel between the state office building here and the Capitol to bring it into ADA compliant. And Madam Chair, my testifier, Mr. Cody Olson, with Public Policy Director of the Council on Disability, saw me once struggling trying to get up that ramp in my wheelchair, and then he came to me with this idea about bringing this bill forward. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier. Okay.
Mr. Olson, welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Cody Olson. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Council on Disability. I'm here tonight to urge you to support this proposal. I'm sure that every member of this committee has likely walked from the state office building to the Capitol building, and we know that it's no easy task. And it's pretty daunting to look at the base of the tunnel and think to yourself, geez, I have to climb up that mountain. Let me tell you something. People in wheelchairs have to do that every single day. and I'm looking to your colleague, Representative Hamilton. This tunnel is not compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act and is far too steep for people with disabilities to travel to navigate safely or at all. So many people using mobility devices such as wheelchairs have to ask for assistance in order to get between these two buildings. Our council has received numerous complaints over a number of years from people with disabilities and senior Minnesotans regarding the slope of the tunnel. This bill would be a strong step forward in fixing this long-known problem. The funds outlined in this bill would hire consultants that would conduct an assessment and determine if there's a reasonable, affordable solution that's within reach to provide access for people. Let's make the People's House accessible to all. Thank you.
Mr. Olson and Representative Hamilton, I understand exactly what you're saying because I walk the tunnels every single day that I'm down here, and I start out at the Transportation Building, and from the Centennial Building to the Judiciary Building, that's a big hill too.
It is.
And then there's those two steps, and how would you do that in the wheelchair?
Madam Chair, I've actually gone through it, but I've went the other direction.
You have to go the other twice
I
as
do.
Far.
And there is a ramp around those two steps, which I'm able to navigate through there. But in order to come back, I must go around to the Transportation Building because I can't make it up that hill on the other side of the Capitol.
Yeah. Mr. Olson, how did you get on $500,000 figure?
This is an estimate from the Department of Administration. I believe that the figure is a standard assessment for determining hiring consultants and determining scope of this project.
Okay, Mr. How did your organization allow us to get along this far?
So,
without a study or without a complaint or without anything? I mean, why is this just coming now after
they hired me
all these years of walking the
house? I don't think she heard you. She didn't hear you.
Okay. I said because they hired me this year.
Nice. Okay. Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll also attest to the fact that those people who have had knee replacements on the long slope going back to the SOB from the Capitol may have difficulty. I slow down considerably on that little slant. Another question, Mr. Olson. So then did you push Representative Hamilton up the slope?
You know, I offered to, but the representative needed exercise that day, so I did not.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So how difficult a task will this be? Because we got to get under the street somehow, right?
That's, Madam Chair, that is what the proposal aims to answer, is how hard will this be? You know, this is a large project, and it'll require lots of forethought and design and planning. And our council has worked on many large public projects of interest in making sure that they are accessible for Minnesotans with disabilities, including Target Field, U.S. Bank Stadium. I just had a tour this afternoon at the new soccer stadium because our council provides accessibility technical assistance for those major public-private projects.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hamilton. We get those bill introductions, and I saw it, and my eyes lit up because I'm like, holy moly. So that's why I'm, like, signed on number two, I think. After my experience last year, I really realized I vividly remember trying to get up, especially going towards the Capitol. I had one my wife was pushing me, and I got one good arm, so we're kind of trying to pull ourselves up. It's pretty pathetic, but it's I just can't imagine, and we need to do something, so I'm glad we are. And as Representative Erdahl, off going down as well, I'm sure you can get it accelerating. And so thank you very much. Yeah, right.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm concerned that somewhat he grazed past what I was considering is this enough money to actually do a decent study? And then second, why are you not looking at the whole loop rather than just that particular connection? Because, I mean, I agree, that's silly, but if I conceptualize what the rest of this is, and by the way, I've never walked it, I would suspect there are more than a few challenges and or barriers along that way, and I don't, why would we even just start with this, whatever that is, 100 yards or so?
Representative Hamilton?
I think you bring up a great point. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you bring up an excellent point where certainly accessibility is an issue that has to be addressed on a holistic scale. You have to look at the entire system rather than solving little symptoms within. And our Capitol complex is absolutely a system that needs to be addressed, and I couldn't agree more with your comments.
And
Representative Hamilton, maybe you need a roundabout.
Maybe, Madam Chair, maybe. But you know what? I guess until you actually have done it yourself, like Representative Lilly has said and others, you know, you don't quite understand maybe the magnitude of the situation. And what I've noticed is there's a lot of traffic when people come to visit us here at the State Office Building and then go to the Capitol and then over to the Senate. So I guess my line of thinking is, and maybe I'm wrong, but the majority of the traffic that we see is right through this segment here. And that's why we're thinking about starting here anyway. But you're absolutely right. I have taken it myself all the way around, but I can go one direction, but I can't go the other. So, yeah.
How have you taken that one over to the Ford Building?
Not yet, Madam Chair. I'll try that one out next.
Careful of dynamite.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
House File 2503, Representative Heinrich. Please begin.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 2503 appropriates $10 million from bonding proceeds to provide funding to complete the preliminary engineering, environmental documentation, final design, and right-of-way acquisition for a bridge over the railroad at Highway 47, Ferry Street Railroad crossing in Anoka. According to the Walz administration, this intersection sees more than 18,000 vehicles and up to 80 trains per day, including on North Star. This overpass would improve regional mobility by allowing for easier, faster travel through this intersection when trains come through. And it's important because of nearby businesses and a school district building. This is also one of the most dangerous intersections in the state. This overpass would allow for safer travel and minimize dangers at the intersection. It would improve safety for motorists, pedestrians, bicyclists, and trains. It would also reduce emergency responder times. The urgency of this project was highlighted by Governor Walz during his visit to Anoka last week, I believe. MnDOT has indicated that this is a high priority for this year, and I appreciate the governor coming to Anoka, and I'm pleased that he understands the importance of this project. The bridge is incredibly important to the community of Anoka, as well as many other communities. I've heard from many people in our community who have contacted me asking if the state can do anything about this dangerous intersection. This project is a point of agreement for North Metro legislators from both parties, and I'm proud to have Republican and Democrat support on this bill. Two co-authors are Representative Zach Stevenson and Representative Dan Wolgamont. And with that, I'll turn it over to Anoka County Commissioner Matt Luck. Thank you for being here, sir.
Commissioner Luck.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this very important bill. I want to say on behalf of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners, I'm here to speak not only on behalf of this $10 million request, but to show our support for it. This bonding request, of course, is going to elevate the intersection at Trunk Highway 47, which is the northern portion of 169, just north of Highway 10. MnDOT's evaluation of this crossing made it the worst rated intersection in the state of Minnesota, so we can be proud of that. But it's been that for many, many years. And just interesting enough, I live two blocks from this. Senator Abler lives two blocks from this. Representative Heinrich lives two blocks from this intersection. And ever since I've lived in the city of Anoka and the areas...
And they've not done anything?
Ever since I've lived in the city of Anoka and the area, this intersection has not changed. In 2003, there was a gate failure that some of you may recall that led to a horrific crash at this location that claimed the lives of 4 teenagers. And this honestly is something that our community did not need to deal with. BNSF reports that there are multiple near misses at this location every single year with the 80 trains that pass through here. This is not just about Anoka residents or Anoka County residents. People use Highway 47, 19,000 vehicles a day going north, and they're being put in harm's way. Again, I'm thankful that the governor identified this as a top priority. I think it was used in identifying the need for a gas tax. And with or without a gas tax, Madam Chair, this project needs to be funded. And right now, Anoka County is committing to an infusion of money to help make this happen. I have a funding scenario laid out where it's about a $56 million project where MnDOT, with the state's help, would probably be into it for about $20 million, which would be a pretty good deal for MnDOT at this point. But about over 20% of it would be coming from local dollars. And so we're committing. This is not a county road, but it affects county residents. So we're committing to trying to make this a reality. So thank you.
Commissioner, look. You've been sitting here a while. You might know what my next question might be. Does this project have a roundabout in it? A calming roundabout?
We were commenting earlier that perhaps we'd have a roundabout for the train coming through to slow it down.
Okay. That's the part I don't understand what you're saying. Is the vehicles have to stop for the train?
Yes, ma'am.
And there's 80 trains a day?
Yes, ma'am.
And these representatives and senator live within, what did you say?
Two blocks.
Two blocks of this? Mm-hmm. And in all these years, this is the first time we've had a bill to correct the situation? Did they go through the railroad first to try to get the railroad to solve the problem?
Well, Madam Chair, the railroad would contribute probably in the area of $2 million required under law to fix this problem. And I know that based on losing the lawsuit on the four teenagers that lost their lives there, that they're probably very willing to probably contribute more if necessary to try and, you know, take away the risk that they experience here. It's an ongoing problem. Not too far from here is the North Star Station in the city of Anoka, and about 1,500 feet away, and that contributes to a lot of the gate failures that are occurring, and so it's something that's long past needing to be done.
And has the railroad been part of the planning process for improving this area?
The railroad was involved with whistle-free application by the city of Anoka, which does, in fact, increase safety in the area because of the medians required for that and the extended gate arms. The train used to blow its whistle, regularly at 3 a.m. in the morning. So I'm sure the senator was woken many times by that. But, you know, it is improved slightly. However, you still have residents that see these gate failures and try to go around. I mean, it's a regular part of I guess, frustration from drivers. And so grade separating it is really the solution here. And it is our hope to and when I say local dollars are available, I do want to say that they are available today. And I have six other commissioners on the board with projects that would very much like to use those dollars that are available today. So my hope is that we can retain those dollars and apply them to this project and help participate in getting this done.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I know that MnDOT is in the room. They we probably should hear from them. Since they've been sitting here all night listening to this, they need a chance to speak. Give us an idea of MnDOT's perspective on this particular project that has gained such high profile in recent days.
Representative Erdahl. Yes, come down. Representative Erdahl.
I think I'll just pass.
Okay. Representative, okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Radin with MnDOT Government Affairs, and this is, as was mentioned, one of the locations that was identified in MnDOT's crude by rail grade crossing study that was performed a few years ago. This is one of the highest locations in the state. It's also a project that's been identified in the governor's transportation funding proposal. If that proposal is enacted, this is one of the projects that would be funded through that proposal.
And where is it on the list for MnDOT? What year did you have it on the list, say, in December or in October? Where was it on the MnDOT list?
Madam Chair, it's not currently funded on the MnDOT list, so we would need additional funding to make the project happen.
But was it on the list to be asked for funding before in October? In October, was it on the list to be asked for funding for this next year?
Yes, Madam Chair, it was one of the projects that the department requested funding for, along with the crossing at Moorhead.
So the Moorhead project was on the list, and this project was on the list?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And it's House File 2503. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just, you know, we have funded a number of rail-grade separation projects. Has this now risen to be the highest priority of the ones that are left to be funded?
Madam Chair, this is Peter Dahlberg with Minnesota Department of Transportation. That is the crossings that we looked at for the crude oil study, the grade separations that were recommended out of there, this would be, of the unfunded projects, this would be the highest priority that is yet to be funded.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is there any money left in that rail grade separation? I believe we, if I remember correctly, we had a pot of money for that work.
Madam Chair, I believe that at this point the money is all committed, and if there is leftover, if projects come in under budget or there's money left over, then we can use that for future projects.
Thank you.
And as long as you're here and we're talking about the grades, what did you call it? Grade separations. Do you have any comments about the Red Wings project that we heard about the other day that is also very dangerous, or at least it slows down traffic a whole lot when the trains are going by?
Madam Chair, would that be the Sturgeon Lake Boulevard?
Yes.
I don't have any comments at this time, but we can do you have anything to add, Eric?
No, Madam Chair, I think we'll have to get you some more information.
Because that's competing. That was heard last one of these days that we've been hearing projects, and that's high on the list also, I understand.
It is, Madam Chair. I believe there was a previous appropriation for that project, so I'm not exactly sure what the request was for last week, but we can look into that.
I think it was like 12 million, wasn't it?
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if I can just kind of identify some funding sources, not that it's committing anyone to funding sources, but I find on the county board when we have these rather large projects, if you're talking about $50-plus million, people tend to recoil a little and they get afraid of the large project cost. I sit on the Transportation Advisory Board, and we've been successful in rewriting criteria so that these type of intersections score well. And if we were successful in receiving the solicitation funding for this, we'd be able to successfully potentially receive $7 million in the next solicitation on that. If we were lining up $10 million from state bonding, as per this bill here, the city would be in for $2 million. The Anoka County Regional Rail Authority would be in for $2 million. The County Solid Waste Fund would be able to buy land and right-of-way for $5 million. Federal is undefined at this point. They're talking about Article I dollars or earmarks, and they may be available for that. As far as the land, it's a current polluting recycler that's located there. MPCA is interested in obviously the pollution part of that. It's identified as a $3.1 million for cleanup of that site. So this project would actually remove a current polluter, would actually identify a cleanup, which is adjacent to the Rum River, to prevent further pollution from occurring. MnDOT would be identified as $20 million. As mentioned earlier, and BNSF at $2 million. And at that point, adding those up, you get real close to completing that $50 to $56 million project. $56 million is high estimate, so something less than that hopefully we can come in at. But by breaking it down into those bite-sized pieces, and provided each funding partner finds it reasonable to contribute that amount, I think we can, in fact, move this project along and can, in fact, ensure that those people traveling on this corridor are not being put in harm's way every single day.
Thank you for that contribution that you just made to us and the suggestion of the total, yep, everyone affected. And that's something that we should think about on all our projects as we're going toward the next step. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Oh, Representative Juergens.
Madam Chair, the Red Wing rail grade separation, $4.8 million.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. It's 9:30. I expect you to get home by 10 o'clock and get a good night's sleep and be here at 8:05, because tomorrow begins the next step. This meeting is adjourned. You've been wonderful tonight. You have been just wonderful every night that we have met. And don't leave yet, because we still have one order of business. Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes from March 26.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The minutes are adopted as printed. And you are, I'm sending you on your way with safety in my mind. And come back just as happily as you left.
And stay away from roundabouts.
And we will be back tomorrow morning at 8:00. This meeting is adjourned.